You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Guns and Butter.
This magnetic field is the only interface that we have. It's the only shield we have against energy from space. And it has been nice and powerful for thousands of years. And now all of a sudden it's taking a dive. The sun peaked in activity between about 1950 and 2000, the peak period of global warming, by the way. And then it just dropped off. We are in the middle of a plunge towards the grand solar minimum.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Ben Davidson. Today's show, Solar Grand Minimums, Magnetic Reversals, and Ice Ages. Ben Davidson is an independent researcher into the science of climate change. One of his websites, suspiciousobservers.org, is an online research community investigating solar activity, earthquakes, earth changes, and weather. His website, earthchanges.org, is where you can find his new disaster prediction app. His website, spaceweathernews.com, is where you will find the archive of his daily short Space News broadcast, aired every morning at 6 a.m. Eastern. He is the author of a new book, Weatherman's Guide to the Sun, Space Weather News. Today we discuss the weakening of Earth's magnetic field, the increase in galactic cosmic rays, the solar grand minimum, Earth's magnetic pole reversal, the albedo factor, and what climactic changes to expect. Ben Davidson, welcome.
It's good to be back.
Could you briefly go over the sun cycles that you went through thoroughly in our last show? Could you talk about the 11-year solar cycle as opposed to the 200 to 400-year solar cycle?
Well, certainly. Every 11 years, the sun goes through a magnetic reversal. That's a very, very rapid process from the planetary and stellar perspective. And as it goes through this process, it spends a few years getting active, we say, having a lot of sunspots, solar flares, creating a lot of ejections of plasma, which when they hit Earth, they do things like create the auroras, the northern and southern lights. And then there's a period of time at the other end of the cycle of this 11 years where the sun is not as active. And that's pretty much a nice little sine wave that goes up and down on that 11-year timescale. And when the sun is reversing its poles is when the sun gets active. But about every 400 years, there's a harmonic of a 200-year cycle that really seems to modulate activity that sends activity much, much lower on the sun. And so the sun will spend 30 to 70 years without even really producing many sunspots. The upturns in the sine wave won't be as high or even really look like it's anything but a flat line at zero, so to speak. And then over the next few hundred years, it builds up in strength, peaks, and then drops off very, very quickly down into the next cycle. So you can picture it like a straight line, but it really kind of looks like the stock market where there's little jagged lines going up and down and up and down along a much larger curve that goes up and down that you can see if you step back and look over enough time periods. So those are the real main important time periods on the sun, and most importantly of all, those large minimum periods after the sun peaks in strength when it drops quickly, those really are correlated with cooler time periods on Earth. The last time it happened on the sun, we had the Little Ice Age on Earth, which was the last time we had multiple million-death famines, million-death pestilence events, things like that.
Do you have any idea as to why the Earth's magnetic field is weakening?
Well, in terms of something intrinsic driving it, that's really difficult to say. We do know it's connected to the movement of Earth's magnetic poles because if you think of the way a roller coaster sort of goes up and up and up and then it peaks and then it slowly comes back down and into the plunge, we're sort of at that crest coming down right now. We haven't quite hit the plunge just yet. But we do notice that the increase in the rate of magnetic field loss is correlated with a increase in the rate of magnetic pole movement. The North and South Poles are speeding up in terms of their movement. The South Pole has already left the continent of Antarctica. The North Magnetic Pole was actually offset up in the islands of Canada in the north, offset from the geographic pole. It is, as we speak, already racing past the geographic North Pole and heading down towards Siberia. Now, in terms of why things are happening that way and why that causes the magnetic field to weaken so much, we can apply some very basic logic to that. And we'll start with how we know that this is part of a much more serious magnetic reversal event. So when people think of a pole flip or a magnetic reversal or however they want to describe it, normally, you know, they see the north at the top, the south at the bottom, and then, you know, they stay on opposite sides of the earth as they sort of shift around. Maybe one goes to the right, one goes to the left, and then they sort of flip and end up on opposite sides. Well, that's not what's happening. The South Magnetic Pole has left Antarctica and is basically creeping up just west of Perth, Australia, into the Indian Ocean. The North Magnetic Pole heading across the Arctic towards Siberia, keep following that down, Siberia, Mongolia, China, India, Indian Ocean. The poles are moving towards one another. Now, that is really interesting. Now, in terms of why we've got a weakening of the magnetic field, well, the way to have the largest magnetic field coverage on the planet would be to have them on opposite sides. The closer you get towards one another, the larger gap you have on one side of the planet. And it just so happens that on the opposite side of the planet from the Indian Ocean, right around the Atlantic, where it meets Brazil, that's where we have something called the South Atlantic Anomaly, an anomalously weak magnetic field there, as it is the place that both poles seem to be moving away from. Now, what's interesting is at the end of that 11-year cycle that I mentioned on the sun, the sun does a pole flip. The sun does this every 11 years. And what's really interesting is those sunspots I mentioned, and more than that, these invisible magnetic bands that we had to use the special magnetic imager to see and detect, begin at very high latitudes near the poles when the sunspots start to form. And then as activity builds, they go towards the center. And then when they hit the center, both the sunspots, the magnetic fields reverse, cancel, and the poles come out the other sides. Well, interestingly, we have Earth's poles both heading towards the equator, very much like we see on the sun, where the magnetic fields start at high latitude and then they come down towards the equator right before the reversal. Well, sure, this has been happening on Earth for a very long time, and the cycle is certainly much longer, but we're seeing a very interesting correlation between the speeding up of the pole movement. We're losing Earth's magnetic field faster and faster, and this is sort of the way that things happen on the sun, even in terms of where we see the magnetism moving on our planet. It does the same thing on the sun. It's just that the sun shows us every 11 years. We don't get a chance to watch it on our planet very often, so we have to take our clues where we can. Now, I didn't really get into how fast Earth's magnetic field is weakening, and we haven't been given good information on that, good solid information on that in a little while, but we do know this. We do know that from sometime in the mid-1800s to about the year 2000, so about 150 years, we lost 10% of Earth's magnetic field. That number was updated to 15% in the year 2010. So that means we lost 10% of Earth's magnetic field in 150 years, and then we lost 5% in only 10 years. Extrapolate that out. 20 years to lose what it had taken us 150 years to lose before. Now, while we haven't gotten a new number, in 2015 and 2016, the European Space Agency's SWARM mission, which monitors Earth's magnetic field, indicated that the trend was continuing, the weakening and the pole movement was accelerating, and that is actually where we got the definitive word because it had not been stated before, that I mentioned that the two were definitively connected. Most people who were studying it knew that and could see that because they were kind of increasing what they were doing at the exact same time, the exact same rate. But now we know that it is indeed a fact that they are correlated. Now, really the only difference in terms of where I fall in this situation versus what the officials will say in this situation is that it's not scary, they say. We have some time left. But they don't do a really good job telling you how much time we have left. If you take a look at the rate of acceleration, you know, losing 10% in 150 years, on track to lose 10% in 20 years, then on track, you do the math, and that gets pretty scary. Back in 1900s, the poles were moving just a few kilometers per year. The North Pole then started moving 10 kilometers per year, 30 kilometers per year. And now it's arguably at 75 or 80 kilometers per year. At that rate of speed, at that rate of increase, how long before that's going hundreds, thousands of kilometers per year? Nobody is hiding the data, but the reason why this isn't major news is because they have not interpreted it properly and communicated that to us. And that is certainly on purpose because this is absolutely global panic level material stuff right here. And, you know, to be honest, let's say that you were in charge of deciding whether or not to let the people know how bad this was before you could try to figure out a way to stop it. You know, assuming that you could have such hubris, you know, that would be a tough thing to do, a tough decision to make. I can't necessarily fault them for wanting to avoid a global panic over this stuff, but it really is what it is. And if you take a look, you won't find officials stating it as I have stated. But in terms of those scary numbers that you can extrapolate, those numbers aren't some fringe or conspiracy stuff. That's their official numbers on the matter. And so it's just a matter of doing some homework, digging a little deeper into just exactly what sort of data they've got and realizing that this is going to play a major, major role in the effect of the sun and those galactic cosmic rays. Because as I said earlier, this magnetic field is the only interface that we have. It's the only shield we have against energy from space. And it has been nice and powerful for thousands of years. And now all of a sudden it's taking a dive. What's happening now is the sun peaked in activity between about 1950 and 2000, the peak period of global warming, by the way. And then it just dropped off. We are in the middle of a plunge towards the grand solar minimum, not just in the 11-year cycle in which we are also going towards the minimum. But over the longer 400-year cycle, we are heading down the fastest part of the roller coaster right now. Haven't hit the bottom quite yet, but we're on our way there, and we probably aren't more than at least one more solar cycle away. Some would argue that we're not even going to get another solar maximum, that we're basically in the minimum now after we descend there now. I think in a couple of years, maybe 5-6 years, we could see some sunspots start to return, but over the long period of time, what does it really matter if that's the last throw or we just had the last throw? We are on our way down now. And that is the real key part of this, because you remember I said Earth had two magnetic shields. Well, we know that the Earth's is weakening, and we've been talking about that. Well, the sun's activity is about to bottom out. We could go decades with what doesn't even really look like a peak in that 11-year cycle. Maybe we'll get some sunspots here and there, but for the most part, we're going to be in grand minimum. And so both of the shields we have against galactic cosmic rays are going to be surging at the planet. Now that, coupled with the fact that we did just go through a recent warming period on the planet, at least in terms of the oceans in some areas, and this might seem counterintuitive until I explain it in a moment. Those two things, the increase in cosmic rays and a sudden warming of a few decades on the planet caused by a grand solar maximum are the two things that trigger many ice ages, or, God forbid, a full ice age.
I'm speaking with independent researcher and author Ben Davidson. Today's show, Solar Grand Minimums, Magnetic Reversals, and Ice Ages. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. You have said that we are going into a solar grand minimum, either right now or after another 11-year solar cycle. What can we expect from our weather as we move into a solar grand minimum?
Well, the primary effect from solar grand minimum is going to be on the El Nino and La Nina cycles, the patterns of moisture that come at the coastlines, that would be the west coasts of the northern hemisphere continents and the east coast of the southern hemisphere continents. Essentially, we think of Seattle as a very rainy place and California as being in a drought that's sort of kind of intensified over the last few years. But that's sort of the last little hitch that way before we swing hard the other way. Areas in the southwest, like Arizona, New Mexico, going to see a lot more rain. Not going to see as much rain in places like the Northeast, places like the northern Midwest. But we'll see much more dangerous weather in the center of the country. The North Atlantic will be producing the kinds of winters much more often that were like 2009, 2010 in Europe. The polar vortex events will be much, much stronger. If you haven't been keeping up with some of the weather news of late, this has sort of become a household term among meteorologists where it wasn't the case just a few years ago. It was a rare thing that we got a polar vortex event. But now that it seems they're happening every year, I mentioned about 6, 7, 8 years ago, it was hitting Europe. 2013, 2014, it was hitting the United States. In the last couple of years, it's been hitting Asia and the Middle East. Interesting to see if Europe will be up next on that one. But so we'll be expecting more of those polar vortex events along with, you know, we'll still be getting record heat. We'll still have hot summers and things like that. It's just that we'll go to more extremes of all kinds. And that includes cold, flood, drought, tornadoes, cyclones, wind, calm. Basically, whatever normally would have been will be intensified.
At the same time that we are going into a solar grand minimum, there are a lot of things happening here on Earth. Could you talk about what the difference is between a magnetic pole reversal and a magnetic excursion?
Well, for practical purposes, the difference is really not much at all. It's just whether or not we get a full reversal or we get a little bit of magnetic chaos on the planet. It's whether or not we go into a situation that is really unfriendly to the way we've chosen to live on this planet and it lasts for hundreds of years, which would be a full reversal, or it would last, you know, only a few decades, which would still be enough to completely change this planet forever. Practically, there's not as much of a difference. Chances are this is going to be a full reversal. It's got all the signs of a full reversal. It's mirroring how the sun does its magnetic reversals, and there's just far too many coincidences between the two to really write it off in any way that could be taken seriously. In terms of how that's going to affect the Earth, much in the same way that a solar grand minimum changes how electricity is going to be affecting the planet and the weather and earthquakes and our health and technology, that is because of the introduction of other energy from outside of the solar system. Now, when we lose Earth's home magnetic field strength as well, and that's what's happening when the sun goes into grand minimum, the sun's magnetic field weakens and allows energy to come in from the rest of the galaxy. Well, Earth has a pretty strong shield against that and the sun normally, but it's weakening now. And so we kind of have this double whammy where our, you know, both of our shields against cosmic rays from the galaxy are going down at pretty much the exact same time. It looks like we're heading into this reversal as we speak. on the planet Earth. And the sun looks like it's either right now or, as you mentioned, in another maybe in another 7 to 10 years, going to be dropping into that minimum too. And so we're really losing most of our protection against the galactic cosmic rays.
Well, what are the effects on Earth of the galactic cosmic rays?
They're much the same as stratospheric volcanic eruptions, and that is cooling. Cosmic rays create the clouds that they help to create and increase the spread and the strength and the size of the clouds that reflect sunlight back off into space. This is called albedo. The two main albedo players on the planet are white clouds and white snow and ice at the poles, things like that. It's basically a measure of how much gets reflected out into space versus how much gets actually absorbed. This would be the notion of nuclear winter if, you know, U.S. and Russia had decided that they were going to fire on each other during the Cold War. And, you know, make it hot, so to speak. The reason why they say that could cause nuclear winter is because it would have literally blocked out the sky with particles. The sunlight wouldn't be able to get to the ground. Same way that volcanoes would be doing that. And recently, two very famous mass extinctions were related not to meteorite impacts, but to volcanic eruptions creating winter. That would be 250 million years ago, the big Permian one, and then another about 770 million years ago. Now, what's interesting about this is they say that it's not that the volcanoes blanketed the entire world in smog and smoke that reflected all the sunlight or didn't let it penetrate. They were saying that the volcanoes were pretty good size, and they were near the equator where a lot of sunlight came in. And the idea is that all they had to do was block out the sun from hitting a certain part of the world and create a little bit of ice there in its wintertime. And then because we're not talking about the little bit of light that gets to the poles, we're talking about one of the highest areas of intake energy in terms of, you know, Earth's energy budget from the sun. All of a sudden, it's reflecting all of that back out into space. It could literally trigger a global ice age, which is what they're saying happened. Now, they use the term, you know, the ice reaching a critical latitude now. This is kind of what we're seeing happening in the South Pole right now, where for the past couple of winters, apart from the record-breaking El Nino, which basically puts a stop and puts a little kink on everything before it does go back to normal, we were seeing record-high Antarctic ice. And, you know, one side is saying, hey, look at all this ice. And the other side is saying, oh, don't pay attention to how much ice there is. It's melting from underneath. And so it's actually just really, really thin ice. And nobody's really talking about the albedo factor. And here's where cosmic rays come in, because we're seeing a chance for cosmic rays to surge and cause those same kinds of clouds all over the planet that reflect the sunlight at the exact same time that a little bit of warming in the oceans is causing a melt event, along with a couple of submarine volcanoes, in Antarctica. Now, why does this matter? Yes, it's true that we are losing some ice mass from underneath, and it is melting, and the thickness is sort of being changed. But the same principle of the ice spreading to a critical latitude is what matters, because what happens when you melt from the underside, and that really is the only long-term change, because of Earth's tilt and the lack of sunlight at the poles in winter, everything that melts in the summertime pretty much refreezes in the winter. You're never going to go to either the North or the South Pole at the winter solstice and not find ice there. It's just it's not how Earth works. So the real question is, what have you really changed long term? Well, you've taken cold, fresh water that was in ice form and you've dumped it into the southern oceans, if not broken off Manhattan-sized ice cubes and sent them floating off into the southern oceans. Well, most of that happens in summertime. So what have you basically done to prepare for next winter? You've freshened the water, which makes it easier to freeze. You've cooled the water, which makes it easier to freeze. And that's even before we're talking about breaking off the Manhattan-sized ice chunks and then just sending those floating off into the southern oceans. Eventually, while you do get a thinning of the ice mass that we consider as the traditional continent of Antarctica, you do get this increasingly spreading, thin, albeit, ice layer in wintertime, which normally wouldn't make one blink twice because that's just going to melt in the summertime. But if it gets to a critical latitude, it's going to start reflecting enough light that summer takes too long to react and respond, and maybe doesn't respond at all. Maybe that year, maybe the next winter. And then once that happens, it goes to the other side, the north. We can't have one hemisphere going cold and the other one staying warm. That's another thing that can't happen on this planet. So let's get back to the galactic cosmic rays and what this means. Well, the galactic cosmic rays are only bolstering everything else that is happening, really starting in the southern oceans. The galactic cosmic rays are also responsible for greasing up lightning storms. They're responsible in large part for hail nucleation, and they have a significant influence on the tropical cyclone, hurricane, typhoon development, regardless of what part of the world you're in. They tend to create increased flood events. They can change weather patterns, causing extreme droughts. But most importantly, as I mentioned, is their reflective properties to cause cooling events, which will, again, make the polar vortex events, which are becoming more common because the sun is weakening, it will make them worse. It'll make the cold events worse, just as we're not going to be without the heat. I mean, even in the last little ice age, summers were still nice and warm and temperate in the areas that are used to seeing them. It's just that winters were absolutely atrocious. And so we're naturally coming now to this point where I have been talking for a while about, you know, blanketing the skies with nuclear fallout, or blanketing the skies with volcanic eruptions, blanketing the skies with clouds. And we're talking about ways to send the planet into an ice age. Well, where does the greenhouse effect fit into all of that? I thought that blanketing the sky with clouds was supposed to warm us all to death. Well, I can tell you that many more climate scientists whose funding and jobs and fame depend on the greenhouse story are in favor of it than physicists who actually study atmospheric physics, chemists who study atmospheric chemistry. It's a function of models, partially based on Venus because it has so much CO2. Well, interestingly, Venus's clouds are yellow and black and brown and other colors other than white. I don't know if you would know the difference between something black and something white left out in the sunshine all day, but one's going to be much warmer than the other at the end of it. The clouds on Venus absorb light. The greenhouse effect doesn't work on a planet with white clouds. And so, as these facts have started to come out and the cooling effect of even clouds really started to creep into the mainstream, there was this interesting fix that the one side tried to put on the situation. And so they said, well, it is the low clouds that cause cooling. It is the high clouds that actually trap in radiative heat, stop radiative heat loss, and warm the planet. Well, this is vastly different than the greenhouse effect we were all taught in school, but let's just run with it. Well, the only way that volcanic aerosols can cool the planet is if they are up high with the clouds that they said would warm the planet. And if you think about it, a cloud close to the ground doesn't cast near the shadow that a cloud much higher up would. All you have to do is go outside on a sunny day, put your hand on the ground, and then slowly lift your hand up. Or wait till sunset and see how much bigger the end of your shadow is than the one at your feet. I don't want to call it a farce. I don't wish to be belittling or disrespectful, but not on this planet is about all I can say for the greenhouse effect in terms of clouds. You know, you don't see clouds in actual greenhouses, because if they were white and they were reflective like that and they didn't allow the light in, they wouldn't warm the plants.
I'm speaking with independent researcher and author Ben Davidson. Today's show, Solar Grand Minimums, Magnetic Reversals, and Ice Ages. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. So now, Ben, it sounds to me like you are saying that the melting of the polar ice caps actually leads to a cooling of the planet rather than a warming. Is that right?
Well, absolutely. You know, this interglacial period that we're in right now, and that's what they call these, the periods in between the glacial periods, may actually be the exception to the rule. We may spend as much or more time in ice ages than we do in temperate times like this. And when ice is locked at the poles and the sun is powerfully blocking out galactic cosmic rays, we have lots of sunlight able to reach the surface, warm the planet, and be absorbed there rather than get reflected. And by the way, the sun's activity, this last grand maximum we were just in over from 1950 to about 2000 during the time of global warming, not only was the peak of the last 400 years, but the peak of the last 11,000 years. So we had our ice locked at the poles, very, very thick, and we had the sun blocking out cosmic rays better than it had in 11,000 years. That's a recipe for warming. But what happens is the oceans end up whatever the oceans can capture will end up having a much greater effect than what hits the land and then slowly radiates off into space. Because what happens is it slowly starts to melt the poles. And, you know, I have to imagine that this situation isn't even uncommon in Earth's, you know, entire geological history. Sometimes we just get these periods where the ice happens to be locked at the poles. The sun happens to be really powerful. We get nice warming periods. I mean, it was much warmer than this when the dinosaurs were around. Maybe this is what happened then. But it just so happens that the two opposite things are happening now. We are taking all of that cold, fresh water, and we are distributing its chemistry and its physical properties in other places where they can have much, much more effect on the global temperatures. We're taking the sun and we are dropping its activity, as was quoted by one very prominent solar physicist, has worked for NASA, may actually still, I don't keep up on exactly his resume, said that the sun is weakening right now faster than at any point in the last 9,000 years. So not only did we peak, but we're dropping off extraordinarily quickly in terms of solar activity. And it's just a bit of bad luck that that's happening at the same time Earth decided it was going to watch the sun do this for literally centuries, millennia. And now it's going to decide, okay, we're going to drop in strength now. When not only is it going to affect the weather, the earthquakes, and our health, but this technology that we all basically rely on for most things in our lives, it's going to take that away as well, because the magnetic field of Earth is the only thing that is stopping the solar wind from really wreaking havoc with Earth's electrical systems. It's estimated that, you know, millions to if not billions of dollars a year are not able to be precisely pegged to space weather, but those numbers are what the estimate is in terms of satellite disruption, communication loss, transformer fires, electrical fires, and other things like that. The only interface we have, the only thing stopping energy from space from having total control over our weather, the earthquakes, the volcanoes, our cardiac and nervous systems, and our technology is the magnetic field. And it's disappearing as we're becoming more and more reliant on it, as generally we're putting more poisons in the planet and our bodies are becoming less healthy, more vulnerable. We're spreading to other parts of the world where maybe we wouldn't have spread there if we knew the 11,000-year earthquake, tsunami, and storm histories for those regions. We're going to find out. We're going to find out why our ancestors, you know, the really genius ones, the ones upon whom we built all of our math, our geometry, our philosophy, our architecture, we're going to learn why they said their most important stories were about the end of the world. And they didn't mean, you know, the complete destruction of the earth. They meant something that completely changed everything about their way of life. And they weren't half as vulnerable as we are. They lived without electricity. They had to deal with the storms and the earthquakes. Imagine if we all had to deal with these things we've been talking about, all on the uptick, storms, floods, droughts, and we can't communicate with each other. There's no power. There's no heat. There's no AC. There's no stores. There's no gas stations. There's no banks.
With regard to the weakening of the Earth's magnetosphere, which you've described, combining that with the shifting magnetic poles on Earth now, when we say a magnetic shift, people automatically think of a full reversal. But isn't it true that where the poles are now, they are actually racing toward each other rather than shifting?
Right, but there's a good chance that's a sign of the actual reversal. The poles can't reside in the same place. But what happens on the sun, interestingly, is those sunspots I mentioned, which have powerful magnetic fields associated with them, the magnetic fields on the sun that are reversing. As they're reversing, we see them appear at high latitude close to the poles, and then they approach each other, meet near the equator, cancel, and the poles pop back out at the north and south. Well, just because Earth's poles are traveling towards one another at the equator shouldn't let anyone think that it's not going to be anything other than a full reversal. In fact, most of the time when we see magnetic excursions, it wouldn't be to this degree. We wouldn't be seeing as much of a weakening of Earth's magnetic field. So, for example, we've gone through a number of magnetic excursions, small ones, in the past few hundreds, to thousands of years. But during that time, the magnetic field strength hasn't really changed all that much. It peaked about 3,000 years ago, slowly started to come down, kind of stabilized until about 150 years ago, and now we're dropping like a rock. And so this is not just some magnetic bend and twist. This is the process of the cyclical reversal actually coming through and really showing signs that it's not slowing down, it's not stopping, it is reversing and showing patterns just like the sun does when it does its reversal. And so, to be honest, it's more a matter of when does it get so bad that conversations like this really aren't even possible anymore. Because, I mean, here's the thing. It's not going to get to the point where we're actually going to be able to watch and get data on the magnetic reversal actually happening and crossing that zero point. There won't be any power by then. This is an event that if it is happening now, and it happens whenever it happens, regardless of what the sun is doing, it will be absolutely life-changing for everyone on this planet, and nothing will ever be the same. Because if it happens right now, then it's a matter of the weather, the earth, literally everything I mentioned being worse.
Is the Earth's magnetic pole shift causing the weakening of Earth's magnetosphere?
Very likely that the changes are causing both the weakening of the overall field and the shift. Something about the Earth system is probably responsible for this. I would say that they are correlated and related to one another rather than one causing or having an effect on the other. The only caveat to that would be, as we mentioned, the North and South Poles are moving towards one another. Well, the exact opposite side of the planet from where the magnetic poles are moving is the place where the field is weakest and where it's weakening the fastest. And that's not really any, you know, big secret. It's kind of common sense if you think about it. You take two planetary magnets, you put them on opposite sides of the planet. Okay, now you start moving them towards one another. Well, the furthest point away from those is probably going to have the least effect from them. That's how magnetism works. And so that's really about the closest thing in terms of a cause and effect. But in general, the weakening of the actual powerful fields themselves, the shifting, it's really part of some other kind of process that would really require us to understand what's happening, not only in the core, but in the mantle as well, much more so than we think we do.
Where geographically on Earth is the magnetosphere the weakest?
It's an area in the South Atlantic that stretches over Brazil as well. It's called the South Atlantic Anomaly. And recently it has basically spread as far east as Africa, and it has spread west into the Pacific, only slightly north and south. Essentially, this is the opposite end of the planet. And something else that's really interesting, the North and South Poles are set to meet pretty close to Java, Indonesia, just south of Sumatra. And this area and the opposite area of the planet have some interesting things in common. So their supposed meeting place and the opposite side of the planet are straddled by magnetic anomalies, the only two of their kind on the planet. So we already discussed the fact that the opposite side of the planet is where the weakest fields are. Well, where are the strongest fields? The strongest fields happen to be in the South Pole, heading towards that meeting place, but at a much slower rate, but which means they're already much closer. And so it's like we have the opposite side of the planet from their meeting place right next to the South Atlantic Anomaly. I mean, they're so close, it'd be like they're next door neighbors. And then we have, you know, maybe there's one house, one neighbor in between the actual meeting place of the poles and the powerful South Magnetic Pole, where the fields are actually strongest. So that's one anomaly. Well, what's on the other side of those? Because both of those anomalies, the weak on one side, the powerful on the other, are both to the south. Well, what's to the north of the meeting place of the poles and that spot in Brazil on the other side of the world? Well, north of Brazil, there's the Bermuda Triangle, which everybody knows very well. It is a magnetic anomaly. But on the other side of the meeting place of the poles, we have something called the Dragon's Triangle. And that is a similar magnetic anomaly that plagues Asia. Not many people know about that one. There are roots and I don't want to say ancient, but historical traditions of taking certain routes and avoiding certain areas that many of the locals there know sort of through experience and story, what we know through instrumentation and story, so to speak.
I'm speaking with independent researcher and author Ben Davidson. Today's show, Solar Grand Minimums, Magnetic Reversals, and Ice Ages. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
And so there's just too many coincidences. I mean, are you going to tell me that? All right, so we have this magnetic anomaly called the Bermuda Triangle. It's got a twin on the other side of the planet. Couple thousand miles to the south of each of these is a magnetic anomaly. Below the south of the Bermuda Triangle is the South Atlantic Anomaly, the weak fields. And south of the meeting place near Indonesia is the powerful fields, the strongest on the planet, the South Pole. And not only do we have this nice little setup right there, but in between both of them is where the North and South magnetic poles are going to meet, and the corresponding opposite side of the planet. There's just no way that's a coincidence. There's just no way. Now, if that was difficult to follow hearing it. There's a video called The Number One Risk to Earth. If you Google that or put it into any search engine, you'll find it. It's also available on earthchanges.org, which I think we mentioned last time. Earthchanges.org is it's supposed to be an educational site that teaches through videos. I did decide to Hollywood it up a little bit because it's hard to keep most people's attention. Most people don't care too much about science. But apart from that, all the facts are real. All the events are real. And it perfectly breaks down with really good explanatory visuals exactly what I just mentioned. And when you see the pattern that is developing on Earth, you just kind of have to shake your head and say, that's not a coincidence. This thing is happening right now.
With regard to these magnetic areas on Earth that you describe as anomalous, the Bermuda Triangle being one of them, do you think these are remnants from a long ago, perhaps a magnetic shift in the poles that created these places in the first place?
That's a really creative thought. I can't honestly tell you I have spent much time thinking about it from that angle. But that might make sense. It, you know, the notion that it would not leave any kind of signature might be naive. It might also be the kind of thing where the reason why they're there is because, hey, that's where the new, you know, that's where the poles are going / the opposite side of the planet. Maybe it's part of the shift that is, you know, happening now that is actually causing those, because this shift has technically been going on for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. We're going towards a low point. But remember, I said the peak was 3,000 years ago. So if the Bermuda Triangle and the Dragon's Triangle popped up, say, 1,000 years ago, you know, who's to say that wasn't the preparation for what's about to happen now? Or even 500 years ago, we probably wouldn't know.
Well, now, Ben, if we actually do have a magnetic pole shift on Earth, and it sounds like we very well may have one, would it happen suddenly?
Well, that's an interesting question. It depends if you're talking about geologic or astronomical time, or if you're talking about the patience of a teenager. It's not the kind of thing that can happen super quickly. If the poles were staying on opposite sides of the planet and sort of tilting while staying on opposite sides of the planet, then they could tilt to a tipping point and then snap quickly, you know, like within a matter of days or even hours. But that's not what's happening here. It's much more of a slow trek. The estimates say we could be anywhere from, you know, a few decades away from things being really, really bad to, you know, just a few years away from things being really, really bad. And the caveat to that is things were really bad with the magnetic field in 2015. Things were really bad in 2011. Things are pretty good. Like, remember how I said we sort of go on that, like the stock market goes up and down and up and down many, many times. But if you step back, it looks like you can see the larger curve. Well, on the larger curve, like I said, we are going down. But there's still little jagged ups and downs along that line. For about 8 to 10 months, I see every signature that we are in an up spike, which is very nice. Nice to get a breather, because I wasn't sure we were actually going to make it out of what happened in 2015 and 2016. That also is detailed for everyone at earthchanges.org. That video actually has a couple of folks who are working independently but who collect checks from the National Weather Service or NOAA or NASA. It's got them very, very interested and a little more than slightly concerned. There's a million different vectors to try to look at this. You could probably break down in detail and ask 100 different questions about, you know, about the magnetic reversal in about as many ways as Walmart has items to sell. But there is one thing that is more important than all of those other things, at least at this stage, because things can get very, very complicated and the bigger picture can get lost quite quickly. The Earth has done nothing but this magnetic cycle with the magnetosphere, as far as we can tell. For millions and millions and millions of years, the Earth goes through this cycle where it's strong and then it weakens and then it reverses and then it's strong and then it weakens and then it reverses. We are about doubly overdue for one. Now, there's not a nice cycle, but we do see they happen about every so often on Earth. And the last definitive one we can see is twice as long as that interval. And no scientist really disagrees with that. We're way overdue for one of these things. And so we have all of the signatures that it is happening right now. And so the question that needs to be asked first is, do you have the guts to bet against global patterns that have been progressing for decades and have not yet shown signs of changing direction, and simultaneously bet against millions of years of a repeating cycle on the planet Earth? Just basically bet that the Earth is not going to follow the cycle this time. We're going to continue to be overdue. All of these signs are to be ignored. I hope I've framed that in a way that it makes one of the decisions sound somewhat less intelligent than the other. And so I consider that one easy. And so it leaves you with the question of, all right, what do you do? Because, all right, what good is information about, all right, there's going to be worse earthquakes and more of them, more volcano eruptions, worse weather, more extreme floods, more extreme droughts, more extreme temperature swings, more extreme hail. What in the world does this all mean for me? This is actually about as easy of an answer as I can give. And that is prepping. It's perhaps a bit more on the list than guns and butter, but it's the simple stuff. And I probably shouldn't even phrase it like that, because some folks who have maybe never thought about it or never really gotten into it might not consider it so simple, but it's prepping for the most extreme disaster, one that there is no recovery from. It's not like they're going to go and they'll find all of the switches and they'll reset all the breakers everywhere. They'll all be melted. They will have gone up in smoke. What this is a change in the electrical nature of the planet. Something else that might be interesting, and I'm going to maybe go a little bit off topic here, but I would love to leave you with this thought, and we can come back and discuss this if you would like, or anything else related to the magnetic reversal. Think about what happens when you get shocked on a doorknob, or the way a plastic bag can stick to your hand, or the way your laundry will stick to other things, or if you've ever gotten out of your car and you've gotten shocked on the door. Imagine there's 10, 100, 1,000 times more electricity. And imagine that the last time that the Earth was really like this, we were just starting to forge iron and metals. Those things would have acted very peculiarly in our atmosphere, in our environment, especially if built the right way. If built in a straight rod, and then you took a very, very thin one and wrapped it around it like a coil, you may have been able to do some things with that electricity that might make you look like a wizard. Before we get to that, though, there's a lot of negativity that comes along with a magnetic reversal. This has been a very positive planet. I know it doesn't always seem that way, but in terms of proliferating the kind of life that humans lead on this planet, it's been incredibly benign for about 400 years, and it's all changing right now. It's happening before our eyes. And that is what's on our plate looking forward.
And I understand that you've recently moved to New Mexico. Why did you choose New Mexico?
New Mexico is one of two areas on the planet that I think is going to come out of this at least not horribly and potentially better in some ways. The primary weather effect on New Mexico is going to be more rain. Pity us. We're insulated from the kind of tornadoes, the kind of major hail that the center of the United States sees. We don't get earthquakes or volcanoes here. Ever since the Sandia Mountain came up and basically fractured this whole region, all the volcanoes died here. There isn't even any magma down there. Yellowstone is one of the only super volcanoes that I have no plans on worrying about for at least a decade, until it stops its regular earthquake upticks and geyser upticks every year, which I know people online use to scare people into thinking Yellowstone is actually getting ready to erupt, but it's kind of the opposite. Those are its pressure releases. When we don't see it doing that for like 10 years, I'll be terrified as to where that pressure is building up. And so since I wasn't going to move to the other location, which is in southern Mongolia, I chose New Mexico.
Ben Davidson, thank you so much again.
Absolutely, Bonnie. It's always a pleasure.
Something happening, yeah. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
I've been speaking with Ben Davidson. Today's show has been Solar Grand Minimums, Magnetic Reversals, and Ice Ages. Ben Davidson is an independent researcher into the science of climate change. One of his websites, suspiciousobservers.org, is an online research community investigating solar activity, earthquakes, earth changes, and weather. His website, earthchanges.org, is where you can find his new disaster prediction app. He is the author of a new book, Weatherman's Guide to the Sun, Space Weather News. Visit his websites at suspiciousobservers.org. Also visit earthchanges.org, spaceweathernews.com, quakewatch.net, and magneticreversal.org. Follow Ben Davidson on Twitter at TheRealSOS. That's TheRealSOS. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yara Mako, and Tony Rango. Visit us at gunsandbutter.org to listen to past programs, comment on shows, or join our email list to receive our newsletter that includes recent shows and updates. Email us at Faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Follow us on Twitter at GNB Radio.
Evolution of the mind. If you seek, then you shall find that we all come from the divine. You dig what I'm saying? Now, if you take heed to the words of wisdom that are written on the walls of life, then universally we will stand, and divided we will fall, because love conquers all. You understand what I'm saying? This is a call to all you sleeping souls. Wake up and take control of your own cipher, and be on the lookout for the spirit snipers trying to steal your life. You know what I'm saying? Look within inside yourself for peace. Give thanks, live life, and release. You dig me? You got me?
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. We return for part two of a talk by Lance DeHaven Smith on SCADs, State Crimes Against Democracy. He thinks that SCAD is a more useful term than conspiracy theory. The CIA cooked up the term conspiracy theory to mock and marginalize critics of the Warren Commission report. Plus, the term SCADs puts the emphasis on crime. We can't prevent the elite from conspiring, but we can detect, prove, and punish crime. Let's do it! This talk is wide-ranging, loosely structured, and full of fascinating details of SCADs past and present. Time is short, so we'll jump back in. Lance DeHaven Smith.
There's a very important false premise that we have like a free press in this country that's aggressive and that is, just can't wait to expose these kind of things. And if you just go to them and show them the evidence, they'll run right over to the cameras. And
you're absolutely correct. There's an article by Cass Sunstein. His wife is Samantha Power, the new UN person. Oh, God. He said exactly what you said. He said the newspapers, that, you know, it would come out. People would sell it. You know, if you knew there was one of these big conspiracies, you'd go to the media and sell your story. You know, what's his evidence for this? And he says, well, like, we found out about the warrantless wiretaps that the Bush administration was doing. Well, yeah, we found out about them, but it was only 2 years after the 2004 election. They knew about it at the New York Times and held that until after the election and would never have told us, except one of their reporters, James Ryson, was publishing a book in 2005 that had this in there, that they had done these warrantless wiretaps. So I think that's a very good point, and you're absolutely correct. There's the assumption that the press would talk, and in reality, the press is the big gatekeeper of all this stuff. So why do we use the term conspiracy theory? I mean, if it's so stupid and un-American and nonsensical and befuddling, why do we use it? Well, it turns out that the term was popularized by the Central Intelligence Agency in response to the critics of the Warren Commission. In 1967, the Central Office of the CIA sent a memo to all its stations around the world telling them to contact their media assets and tell them if they come across people criticizing the Warren Commission report to call them conspiracy theorists, say there's no evidence of a conspiracy, say that if there had been a conspiracy, somebody would have talked, the newspapers would have uncovered it. It's all the things we hear today about conspiracy theory, the criticisms of it, were in this memo. In my book, I replicate the memo in the appendix. This was reported in the New York Times in 1976 when the memo was declassified, and mistakenly declassified. It was in the news one day, and that was it. Well, they also said, they said you should tell people who are labeling people conspiracy theorists, they should say that the conspiracy theorist is under the sway of communist propagandists. So the idea was if you talked about Kennedy being assassinated by one of our people, that it was something the communists were pushing on us. And it was applied to the assassinations of Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy, Wallace. When Robert Kennedy was assassinated, the night he was assassinated, the police are radioing. They were chasing people who they thought might have been involved in it. One of them was this woman that wore the polka dot dress. This is kind of an arcane point. But what's interesting is the police say on the radio, don't chase this person. We don't want another conspiracy theory. So they're already using this term by 1968 and being concerned about it. One of the things I'm trying to do is develop a forensic science for tracking these memes, because that's what the government's doing. And we realize that. We know that they, you know, when they devise a war plan, they'll think up some term like Operation Iraqi Liberation. Oh, no, that was oil. Operation Iraqi Freedom. We know they do that. But I don't think we realize that they're doing it secretly and inserting these memes into our public discourse. Yes, sir.
Yeah. What was the very first reference you found in use?
The term conspiracy theory had come up in a book by Charles and Mary Beard in 1913. It was called The Conspiracy Theory of the 14th Amendment, and it was written about in academic. It wasn't popular. You can't find it in the newspapers. And there was a letter to an editor around 1935 complaining about the conspiracy mentality. And there was a story in like 1963 that was before the Kennedy assassination that was about the conspiracy mindset. So you pick up a little thing, but what you don't see is it being used 25, 30 times. The main problem we have that has influenced our thinking with the conspiracy theory label is it causes us to look at these events as isolated events. Like, we have conspiracy theories of Kennedy, of John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, but we don't have conspiracy theories of assassinations. We don't look at them together. If I say Kennedy assassination, I'm talking about President Kennedy. Nobody ever uses the term Kennedy assassinations, plural. But those were connected conspiracies, obviously. John Kennedy was running for president. His brother was running for president. When does his brother get killed? His brother gets killed on the night he wins the Democratic primary in California. Okay, so there's obvious connections, and yet we don't say Kennedy assassinations. We don't say 9/11 anthrax. The anthrax occurred immediately after 9/11. It shaped the way we saw it. 9/11 was scary, but it was just in New York. The anthrax could have hit anybody, anywhere. It was very frightening. And yet we separate those in our minds. The term conspiracy, if you have multiple conspiracies, that's called organized crime or serial crime. And we should use that term instead of conspiracy. But it causes us to look at events in isolation. 2000 and the 2004 elections, those were almost identical in terms of the sabotage that was done. Making it difficult for minorities to register, putting too few machines in the urban Democratic strongholds so the lines were real long and people would get discouraged and go away. There were computer anomalies. In Florida, the exit polls showed Gore winning by 3 percentage points. And when the voting returns came back, it was Bush at 500 votes more. Same in Ohio. The exit polls showed Kerry winning by 2 or 3 points. And then when they count the votes, well, that should tell you something. I call it incident-specific myopia. And I point out to people that this is the opposite of the way we view ordinary crimes. If a husband marries a man marries a wealthy woman and she falls in the shower and is killed and he inherits a bunch of money, we're automatically suspicious because it's an improbable event and he benefited. If he then marries another wealthy woman and she falls and hurts or gets killed in a similar accident, we're convinced that this is a plot. I mean, our minds are automatically suspicious. What happened, what they've done, and this is the way these memes work, they're normal, rational processes. When you see things occur, you tend to look at a pattern and you suspect things. And what the conspiracy theory meme is doing is breaking down that rational process. You're not supposed to think about connected crimes. You're not supposed to suspect these people. And so you look at them one by one, and you miss the connections between them. This is a Cass Sunstein article. I may have mentioned it. He is advocating that people who are in conspiracy theory groups online, me and my friends, I guess is who he's talking about, that they should be cognitively disrupted. What I think he means is that they're planting trolls, they're sometimes called, people to get on these online conversations and introduce arguments and ideas that are disruptive and make it very difficult for people to coalesce and strategize constructively about that. I mean, it is breathtaking hypocrisy that what he's proposing, and this is a guy who was head of information, the Office of Information in the Obama administration until recently. What he's saying is we're going to conspire to stop people from saying the government conspires. It's unbelievable. I mean, these people are twisted, deeply twisted. Yeah, I call it linguistic thought control. I think we have to have a name for this stuff, subliminal indoctrination. Sounds kind of paranoid, but if they're double speak, yes. Yeah, I went back and read 1984, and he has an appendix in that book that talks about the language and how they were, he thought that they were taking out the emotions out of language and using all these acronyms that shaped your thinking and left you unable to connect your own life to what was going on. I just have a list of 18, 20 SCADs. We've talked about most of these. I include McCarthyism, Oswald, Copeland, 68 October by Ellsberg, the attempted assassination of George Wallace. Wallace was running as a third-party candidate. He had the potential to draw away votes from Nixon. Ross Perot, when he ran, he got 20% of the votes nationally, but he took those votes from Bush, and Bush lost to Clinton. So this was a real fear. Wallace said that Nixon was behind it. He went to the FBI and complained about it. He said, how could this guy be stalking me? Where did he get the weapon? He was staying in expensive hotels. How did he know my schedule? You know, it just doesn't make sense. Somebody had to be helping him. Watergate, we discussed. The attempt on Reagan is a little less clear, but I'll show you some stuff that might surprise you.
Why do you suppose they go for Reagan?
Reagan got a shot 3 months after he was in office. And the person who shot him, this guy Hinckley, Bush was asked about Hinckley. Did he know him? Had he ever heard of him? He said, no, I don't know anything about these people. I've never heard of them. I have no connection to them. Well, it turns out the Hinckley family had been donating money to his campaigns, lots of money, big money. And then it turned out that one of the Bush sons,
Neil,
was having dinner with Hinckley's brother the night after the assassination. And you see connections like that, and it's very troubling. It's very troubling. So I include this as a low probability, but I would still consider it. Wellstone I have in here, he was killed in a plane crash when the Senate was evenly divided and debating about going to war in Iraq. I tell my students, do not fly on airplanes with U.S. senators when the Senate is evenly divided. Okay? It's a big risk. There's practical implications to my theories and research. Iraq, 2004. The bogus terror alerts were when they would raise the thing from yellow to orange. Every time Bush's support would go down, there'd be a terror alert. And that's a manipulation. If you just look at the confirmation, most of these are well confirmed. Maybe not officially, but many officially. A few are not so well confirmed, but still are awfully suspicious, including 9/11. And then the low confirmation are the ones that we just haven't gotten confessions. We haven't gotten people talking. We haven't gotten, you know, forensic evidence, medical evidence, and that kind of thing. People who do these kinds of crimes, most of them are lawyers. They know the law. They know it very carefully, and they know what they can do with evidence and so on. They've sworn these secrecy oaths. Ellsberg said that the oath that they swear means that even if they're in Congress and they're asked something, they can't say that they know something, that it overrides their sworn oath to Congress. Compartmentalization, conflicts of interest, we know about that. And then, of course, if worse comes to worse, when we've finally got them pinned down, they pardon everybody who might testify against them. They tend to cluster around elections. So the 64 election, the 68 election, 72 election, the 80, 2000, 2004. So when you have a presidential election, be on the lookout for these things. If you look at what are the most common modus operandi, I'm trying to use this criminological lingo because I find it helpful. The most common is assassinations, and I'm counting these as six, and Leahy and Daschle, the Senate leaders who received the anthrax letters, I don't include in this six, so it would be eight if you included that. So that's a very common one. And it's an old historic political crime. You got a somebody that you're competing with, kill them. Manipulation of foreign events to stir up fear and warmongering is almost as common as assassination. And that's another one that is the language speaks to us about false flag operations and provocations, agents provocateur, that kind of thing. Provocations, the election tampering, and then the burglary. The black bag job is something that they do, but they do, it's more likely they do that to us as opposed to a very high leader. But the most common ones use the skills and tactics of the military and intelligence. It's a signature, in effect. If you look at the confirmation in terms of so these are the high confirmation, the medium, and the low. And if you look at what they are, the things that we don't learn about are assassinations. They're very hard. People don't confess to murder. It's really hard to get that out. They will confess to the... McNamara confessed that they knew the Gulf of Tonkin was bogus. He said this on a film. So they'll confess to things like that, but they won't confess to treason and assassination. It's hard to get that information out. And I think that that's the attitude we should have. When we see an assassination, we should realize that it's going to be very hard for us to uncover this. We should be very skeptical about what the government says, and we should be insisting on a thorough investigation. Most of the time, these are done for the benefit of military activities, either start a war, prolong a war, create fear of a war. And there are some that are just political opportunism. You know, Nixon was a murderer, and Johnson was. This has come out recently that he had a hired killer that worked for him in Texas. And when you're running against people like that, you know, you likely, think about it. Basically, everybody that ran against Nixon got killed, okay? John Kennedy beat Nixon in 1960. He gets assassinated in 63. Robert Kennedy is running against him in 1968 and would have won if he lived. He gets whacked. And George Wallace is running against him in 72 and he gets killed or crippled. You know, if you saw that in an ordinary crime, you'd be saying, well, this is obvious. We should be talking to Nixon. Let's find out where this guy was. What did his friends say? Let's talk to his underlings. Let's promise them if they'll confess that we'll give them a good deal. Any ordinary guy, that's what would happen to him. President of the United States, forget it.
It's not illegal if the president does it.
Yeah, that's what their attitude is. That's what Nixon said. If you look at the assassination targets, it's only presidents. It's not vice presidents, senators and presidents. It's not the Supreme Court. I don't want to put any thoughts in anybody's head. But the Supreme Court justices, they don't have protection. They go jogging down in Washington. They have enormous power. People say, well, people don't know who they were. Let me tell you, when I was growing up, there were signs all over the South that said, impeach Earl Warren. Literally. People knew who Earl Warren was in the South. No House member since Gabrielle or until Gabrielle, and there's no evidence to suggest that that was any kind of scan. But, you know, there are a lot of House members. I was in Washington about 6 months ago, was walking around Congress, and Ron Paul came walking by. And I saw her, I said, boy, I just really, you inspire me. I think it's great the things you do. But I thought, he said thanks and walked on, and I thought, hell, I could have killed him right there. I mean, I wouldn't have done it. I don't want you to get that. But, because I like him at least. But, I mean, the point was, he had no protection. He was just out in the open, and there were no gun screens or anything. There was nothing to prevent people from being around him with weapons. So it's bizarre that it's the president that gets targeted. The one thing about the presidents, they only get shot when you've got a very different vice president. Like Johnson was a real hawk when Kennedy was a dove. George H.W. Bush was a CIA-connected guy when Reagan was more of an isolationist in some ways. And I think the Bushes figured this out, actually. When George H.W. Bush appointed Dan Quayle as his VP, sort of assassination insurance. Nixon actually said when Ford got appointed vice president, he said, uh-oh, I am really worried now. I wasn't worried before when had Agnew, because they weren't going to impeach me and have Agnew president. But now Ford is vice president, I'm in trouble. So they think about this. they're increasing, and they tend to occur around particular administrations. The Bush people are really very suspect. I think we should be very, very cautious about them. There have been a lot of crimes committed while members of their family were in office. And Jeb Bush may run, so. And Kennedy, Robert Kennedy Jr., came out about 6 months ago and said that he thought it was a conspiracy and that Douglas's book, The Unspeakable, was a good account of it. The Kennedys have never spoken about this. And, you know, people say, well, why? I mean, why would they not speak out? For one thing, they're afraid of getting killed, which is a reasonable fear. But the other thing is there's the elites. This is like the worst taboo. If you speak ill of a fellow elite, it's just a terrible thing. So I think they think of protecting their class interest as more important.
When your articles are rejected by official magazines and publications, why not go to somewhere like Mother Jones, the Progressive, some of the other really good alternative media out there? It was Mother Jones that exposed the Romney comment before the last...
Do you know what? I've tried to publish in the New York Times. I did get this article in the Guardian. But frankly, my perception is that the left will go all the way up to, but they won't step over the line where we talk about crime. I mean, and we can talk about scandal. We can talk about immoral behavior. But when we talk about crime, that these people are murderers, these people are traitors, these people are embezzlers, you know, we can't talk. We can't say that. That's just too much. It's too much because it implies an action in response. If our leaders are murderers, we can't just sit back. If they're unscrupulous, well, that's okay. If you're, you know, having an affair with the intern, well, that's okay.
I would like to hear your interpretation of why Ronald Reagan chose George H.W. Bush as his vice president.
The story is that Rockefeller went to him and said, "You got to do it. This is our guy." They said in the CIA, Bush had been in the CIA, and they said when the campaign posters were put up surreptitiously in the CIA, there'd be a campaign poster for Reagan Bush, but they would always tear it and take Reagan out. And it was just, but look, they named the building after Bush, the CIA headquarters building. They say he protected them during the Church Commission hearings and all that. I mean, if we saw the Soviet Union, the head of the KGB, become the head of the Soviet Union, which is what we saw with Putin, basically becomes the head of Russia, I mean, we'd automatically think, well, this guy's connected. This guy's going to be a gangster of sorts. But we haven't said that about our own system. The Syria is a SCAD, if we go into that. Libya, in a way, is a SCAD. It was a violation of international law. It subverted the democratic process because Obama got a tortured Office of Legal Counsel memo saying it wasn't an act of war. So he knew what he was doing. He was subverting it. Uncertain, the Boston Marathon bombing. I was looking for a connection. There was a peculiar thing that did happen, and that was there were ricin letters that were mailed in Alabama or somewhere. And it occurred right with this. And so I got to thinking, well, you know, this is very similar to 9/11, where you have this bombing terrorist attack and then the biological attack. And I got to thinking, well, maybe it was a booster shot, you know, from the higher-ups. They thought, you know, we needed a little jolt. They didn't want to do a full-blown nuclear attack or something like that, dirty nuclear bomb somewhere, really get us freaked. But they felt like they needed to. I know it sounds very paranoid, but that's what if you go back and read NSC 68 and you realize that the government doesn't trust you, the government thinks you are a liability in their effort to maintain your freedom, your viability. Once you realize that, you have to understand they see this as a responsibility to take care of us, and that may mean sacrificing us at times.
Behind all of this, these cats, appears to be a huge profit motive. And don't we see the banks?
Yes.
Who make their highest profit by far funding war and defense contractors.
Yes.
And these are the people at the apex of these crimes.
Yes.
They make a huge amount of money by
Yes.
keeping war.
Yeah, it's a war machine, and it's a financial machine. I have a friend in Australia that writes about economic scads. They're state crimes that are anti-democratic, but their motive is profit. Yes, there's an economic component. To some extent, I try to stay on the crimes and get the empirical evidence and then abstract away from that to consider what's the nature of the criminal. And what I'm seeing is all the crimes, or very many of them, are related to war and militarism, and certainly they benefit the armaments companies and to some extent the banks as well. Part of what I'm trying to do is create a foundation of work and forensic methods. I think of it as SCAD detectives. We're like Sherlock Holmes for the 21st century. And we're trying to figure out, how do we investigate these people? Observation methods for SCAD detection, for state crime detection. And for example, after every election, we should have an audit of the ballots against the exit polls. If we can't do that, we should at least have the statisticians look at it. They've got techniques now where they can tell when the numbers are made up, and there are certain patterns to look for. And if the government won't do it for us, we're going to have to do it for ourselves. And that's pretty much what's been happening. After 2004, Steve Freeman, a statistician at the University of Pennsylvania, looked at all the exit polls and the election returns and compared them and found that 10 out of 11 battleground states had statistically improbable deviations of the returns from the exit polls, and they always favored Bush. And he calculated the probability of that, given the difference between the exit poll and the returns and the sample sizes, and he said the odds of that happening by chance were like a zillion to one. But we need methods like that. Yes, sir, here you.
Well, we privatized the election counters. Contract went out.
It's unbelievable.
The software is private property?
Yes, it's unbelievable. And why we would put our elections in the hands of people that even if they're angels, why we would do that, it just makes no sense. I was when the Orange Revolution occurred in the Ukraine, one of their candidates, who eventually wins the presidency, was poisoned with something that made his face real bad. I don't know if you remember that. And they were interviewing his campaign manager right before the election, and they said, well, you know, do you have any worries about the election? He says, yeah, I'm worried about keeping my guy alive. And, you know, they said, well, really? He said, well, yeah, think about it. We're talking billions of dollars in government contracts and policy affecting, you know, all kinds of things. You think the stakes are not enormously high? People wouldn't do something like that? Well, think about the United States elections. Huge financial implications, huge ideological implications. And then we're going to set it up where we have voting machines with no paper trail that are vulnerable to hacking, and that you can actually plant programs in the machines that switch votes between candidates and then erase themselves at the end of the day.
Here we must end part two of Lance DeHaven Smith's intriguing talk on SCADs, State Crimes Against Democracy. Find us on the web at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, advising illegitimi non carborundum, and inviting you to tune in again next week. Ciao.
This is Jeff Blankford. My guest today, Joe Lauria, is a friend, veteran foreign affairs journalist. He has written for the Boston Globe, the Sunday Times of London, the Wall Street Journal, among other newspapers, and most recently his writings can be found on Consortium News. He is the author of How I Lost by Hillary Clinton, published by OR Books in June, and he can be reached at Joe Lauria @gmail.com. We spoke last December, a year ago, on the same subject, close to an anti-Russian warmonger, in which he only has only intensified since then. Welcome, Joe Loria, Takes on the World.
How are you doing, Jeff?
I'm doing fine. I'm glad to reach you. A year ago, we spoke about the warmongering campaign against Russia that was precipitated by the U.S.-backed coup in Ukraine. And now, judging from your long and disturbing article, the desire to get Trump out of office by any means necessary seems to have driven the liberals to include shutting down the First Amendment and the media. Tell us what's been going on. It's very disturbing when you find the fairness and accuracy in media. And the American Civil Liberties Union is barking up the wrong tree.
Yeah, I'm afraid that the people at that organization and across academia and journalism are a subject to a fear that's spreading across the United States, not unlike, unfortunately, the McCarthyism of the 50s. It's been compared to that, and I think aptly. It's a fear about opposing this narrative about Trump's collusion, alleged collusion with Russia, and Russia's threat to the United States, their interference in the election, to express skepticism about that. Not denial of that, but just skepticism about that, because the evidence has not come forward to really confirm that, has caused people, I believe, to get along with the dominant narrative here and to be afraid to criticize that. And this is something I experienced firsthand when I wrote a piece about Russiagate that took into account that right after we learned that Hillary Clinton's campaign, as well as the Democratic National Committee, had paid for the dossier from Christopher Steele, the former MI6 British agent, which was a piece of opposition research, not an intelligence document. Totally different. It was not vetted by himself. It was not vetted by his agency. It was not vetted by other agencies. It's a piece of opposition research, negative stuff to throw against an opponent. I concluded that that was the basis of the January 6th, good part of the basis, the January 6th so-called intelligence assessment by the FBI, the CIA, and the NSA. That is the basis for the belief in the Russiagate story. It's a big part of it. And this was not vetted by all 17 intelligence agencies. It was not a national intelligence estimate. It was no dissenting opinion. It was handpicked analysts by James Clapper from those three agencies. He could pick people who he knew would give him what he wanted in terms of blaming Russia for this catastrophe of Donald Trump being elected. But I think that the Russiagate story fits into a much older story, a strategy to oppose Russia since Yeltsin is gone, basically, and since Medvedev is gone. Putin has stood up to the United States and not allowed the Americans to run roughshod over the country as they did in the 1990s when they had Yeltsin as their puppet, really, when Wall Street came in and had alliances with local oligarchs and acid stripped the country and impoverished the people. And Putin has restored sovereignty to the country. And this is something that American leadership cannot tolerate. So the story of Russiagate fits into that, in my opinion. And it also has increased the geopolitical tension between nuclear-armed U.S. and Russia enormously. So my article said that the Steele dossier and the CrowdStrike examination of the DNC computers, a private company that was hired by the DNC after they did not allow the FBI to examine their server to see who may have hacked them for the emails that WikiLeaks eventually published. And the CrowdStrike company was run by an anti-Putin Russian. It took one day to determine that Russia had did it, and the clues they gave were that the first name of the Soviet intelligence chief was seen in the metadata, and there were Cyrillic letters. And this is very amateurish clues for a sophisticated operation that CrowdStrike said that it was. And we later learned from Voice of America in March of last year that CrowdStrike, the same software it used to blame Russia for the DNC hack, had also blamed Russia for hacking into howitzers of the Ukrainian army on the battlefield in eastern Ukraine, and that turned out to be false, that Russia had not hacked that, and that was denied by the Ukrainian army, not by Russia. And they had to rewrite CrowdStrike did the next day, that very software, on March 24th. So both of them are very shaky foundations. And that article I wrote, including the geopolitical tensions that Russiagate story has caused, as well as this new McCarthyism, which I'd like to talk to a little bit more later if you can, was an article I wrote for Conservative News at the end of October. I then published it myself at the Huffington Post as a longtime contributor since February of 2006. I can contribute directly onto the site. Within 24 hours, that article was taken down. There was no explanation at all given to me before or after. They ignored my inquiries. I could only conclude it was for political and editorial reasons. It did not fit the Russiagate narrative that a Democratic Party-leaning website like Huff, or I should say HuffPost, is not the Huffington Post anymore. It's under new management, and Lydia Pogan, a former New York Times reporter and editor, and it's taken a very different turn from the old Huffington Post. I can only conclude they censored this article. I don't like to use that word. I think it's overused. I put a petition up on change.org. It's gotten over 2,000 signatures. Max Blumenthal, Tariq Ali, people of this type, Ray McGovern, have all supported me on this. Ray McGovern put it on his blog, and that really took off in terms of getting attention to this act. We could only call censorship, and that's what the ACLU and FAIR, their leaders, I learned, were rejected supporting me because they personally believed in the Russiagate story. But the whole point of those organizations are not about whether they agree with me or not, and whether I have the right to write such an article like that. Should it be taken down for political reasons? And in one of the petition signers wrote that she did not agree with my article about Russiagate, that she does believe it, but she signed it because she believed I had the right to publish such an article. And this is the whole point about being against censorship. So that was very disappointing about ACLU, which also refused to support Russia Today or RT reporters when they were forced to register as foreign agents. But that's something else we could talk about a bit later if you'd like.
Well, actually, the RT situation is quite extraordinary as well. If any of you listeners have gone on your computer to watch RT, you will find that it is anything but a propaganda outfit any more than any news broadcast you will see in the United States, except they will have more content and less entertainment and fluff. And many of the hosts have been our Americans, journalists with journalistic experience like Larry King, Peter Lavelle, and so on. Excellent economic program. I have to say I've been a guest on RT myself. And the idea that RT has to register as a foreign agent for Russia is extraordinary, but it goes to an example of the extent of the insanity that this Russiagate has produced. Your article being censored and not being defended by the ACLU is extraordinary, given their history of defending Nazis marching in Skokie, for example.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, exactly, which was a principled stand. In the subsequent article I wrote that you've read and you have asked me to speak about on this interview is about how it starts with this explanation, what happened to me at the Post, but I broaden it out into the larger landscape of this growing censorship in the U.S. and in Europe. And I focus in on the class nature of censorship. It's an elite. It's really as old as civilization and a powerful elite that needs to control information that the population has so that it's hidden from the people how exactly elites are benefiting at the expense of everyone else and not to give dangerous information so they might rebel. And what we've seen now is something has changed because articles, especially on foreign policy, have been suppressed. News has been suppressed in American corporate newspapers for decades. But we've seen an elite concentration of ownership of media in the last couple of decades and recently. But now we've seen also dissident websites on the internet and RT in particular are the places where this suppressed news and corporate media, and I have some personal experiences with big newspapers that work for where articles were absolutely rejected because they would undermine American foreign policy, even though they were true. These stories can come out and seep out now onto these listening websites like Consorted News, Calendar Punch, so many of them, and on RT. So their plan to suppress in their own owned corporate media is troubled by the fact that we've learned in the 2016 election that there's a huge number of Americans who are fed up with 30 years of neoliberal policies, and the bipartisan elite sees this on the left and the right, the Bernie Sanders insurgency and Trump's victory has alarmed them. So they have to double down to try to stop this information from seeping out in other places that they don't control, and that would be these websites and RT. So we've seen a whole series of actions, particularly accelerating in the last month or so, against RT and against websites. And the way the government can do this legally is by having private sector do it for them, because the First Amendment does not apply to the private sector. It's government, Congress in particular, as the Constitution said, that cannot make a law to suppress the freedom of the press. So how do they do this? They go to private companies like Google, which have announced now that they have their deranking RT articles. Eric Schmidt said he doesn't believe in censorship cynically, but he's actually going to derank, make it much harder to find articles from RT. They're hiring 10,000 more censors or people to go through YouTube videos to remove videos that does not fit into the dominant narrative that the elite wants. And we have Facebook also alerting their users if they've seen some of these ads. These ads are $100,000 worth of ads, half of them coming after the election. It supposedly turned this for Hillary Clinton. It's too silly to even comment about. We've had some things that government can do. For example, I bring up in my article that during the Second World War, there was direct censorship that was never challenged of the press during the war. And during the Korean War, MacArthur asked for self-censorship of the media, and he got that until about July of 1950, when suddenly the press started writing articles critical of the command, because Americans were battlefield bosses, and then the government said that those articles had to stop. So direct censorship was again applied. But they go to the private sector first to see if they will cooperate. So that's what I think they're doing with Google and with Facebook. Now, what the government can do directly and what they have was want to make RT register as a foreign agent. And this is quite troubling because a week ago Tuesday, the State Department spokeswoman said that that would not affect how RT collects or distributes their news. The next day, on Wednesday, the day after she said that, the Congressional Press Gallery pulled the RT press passes from their correspondents because they had not registered as a foreign agent. So, there's complete contradiction there. We've got NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, the most powerful military alliance in history, did a huge study on a small website in Canada called Global Research. The Globe and Mail then in Toronto did a huge hit piece on them. Why? Because they are sharing a lot of articles, mostly it's just a clearinghouse for a lot of dissident articles. Many of consortium news articles are republished there. A handful of mine have been republished there. But NATO and the Globe and Mail present this as a danger to the free world because of global research. La Repubblica in Italy did the same attack on a website called Antidiplomatico, another dissident website. And in addition to that, we're seeing direct McCarthyist attacks on individuals. The Washington Post a week or so ago did a hit piece on Alex Ovechkin, a professional hockey player, a Russian, playing in the United States in Washington area on the Washington Capitals. This Washington Post piece was just a smear against this individual because why? He, like 86% of other Russians, supports his president. And he started a website about that. They've implied that he was just a dupe. Why should he be supporting Putin? We saw John Kiriakou, the CIA whistleblower who blew the whistle on torture, get kicked off a panel in Europe because he hosts a show on Radio Sputnik, and the person who had him kicked off was a Bernie Sanders supporter. And then last week at the Swiss Press Club in Geneva, Bealey, I'm forgetting her first name.
Vanessa.
Vanessa Bealey was presenting information about the White Helmets, this rescue organization in rebel areas in Syria, which she has evidence of. She wanted to present that they had ties to Al-Qaeda. And the Reporters Without Borders put that in the same category as ACLU and FAIR. You made a huge pressure on the Swiss Press Club to kick her off that panel, and the Swiss Press Club president stood against them and let her speak. And then a week later, 100,000 francs was cut out of their budget from the Swiss government, and he leaves because of that. So these are just some examples of what we're seeing in an elite that feels under pressure from in Europe and in the United States from a disgruntled population because these policies are transferring a huge amount of wealth from the people to the 1% over the last 30 years. There are foreign wars that have no meaning for anybody, any American working or European working class. They're fed up with that, and they have now information they can get from RT and from dissident websites, and it doesn't have anywhere near the spread, of course, that corporate media does, but they want to stop it. And they're using these tactics, and this is extremely troubling to anyone who cares about a free press and a real marketplace of ideas.
Well, that January intelligence report, one-third of it was devoted to attacking RT about information that was it had nothing to do with the elections. It was they see this very small channel in terms of reach to the United States as a major threat. One can imagine what would have happened had Hillary Clinton actually won the election, because she was the one who ran the most overtly warlike campaign of any Democrat in my lifetime. Lyndon Johnson pretended to be a peace lover. He wasn't. But Hillary Clinton ran a campaign saying she would stand up to Putin. And so it's the people who supported her and the liberal intelligentsia and the Democratic Party are continuing what she promised. No?
Yes, and that's the subject of the book that you mentioned that I wrote, or books, How I Lost to Clinton. We got the WikiLeaks emails that were published both from VNC and Podesta. I wrote the introduction and annotated it, and Julian Assange wrote the foreword. And it was, my thrust of that was Hillary Clinton was a war hawk, of course, and an economic elitist. We don't know for sure how she would have acted in this first year, but we could tell you this, that she still wanted a no-fly zone in Syria, even after General Joseph Dunford testified to Congress, to a joint session, that he was worried about this because it could mean war with Russia, a no-fly zone. And he testified about that. An open hearing, and she went on the last debate and still called for this. So she was bellicose, there's no question about that. She wanted intervention directly in Syria. We know from one of the stories that I had suppressed that I tried to get published, this Defense Intelligence Agency document of August 2012 that warned of the coming Islamic State. That's 2 years before the Islamic State was formed, that the U.S. was supporting the establishment of a Salafist principality in eastern Syria along with Turkey and the Gulf Arabs. Put pressure on Assad. And then if you fast forward to September 2016, you have a leaked conversation with John Kerry when he was Secretary of State. He was saying, I mean, he knows why Russia intervened, because Daesh was marching towards Damascus. And we saw them moving towards Damascus, and we watched them, he said, and we wanted them to get Assad to leave, but Russia came in and saved him. So he was admitting there that the U.S. never really fought ISIS inside Syria. They did in Iraq. It's a totally different war. But not in Syria, and that they were using ISIS, just like that document had said, in order to put pressure on Assad to get out. And that was never published in a corporate newspaper that I'm aware of, because I could not twice have it rejected by a big newspaper in the United States. That's just one small example, along with the Ukraine coup d'etat, and what happened in Libya, the British parliamentary report that said there was no imminent danger of any kind of massacre or genocide in Libya, and that was suppressed by the Western media. So there's so many examples. Those stories get out on Russian media. They have to be stopped. Hillary Clinton was the architect of that Libya war. My book clearly shows from the emails from WikiLeaks show that that's the case. I'm not here to celebrate Donald Trump at all. I'm horrified by so many things behind this tax bill I just read. Has now been finalized between the House and the Senate. It's a horrendous bill that crushes people that voted, a lot of people that voted for him, working class people who are fed up and thought he was going to be different. And he's totally stabbed them in the back, which I think will make trouble for the elites even more. People are going to be even angrier next time because of that. So I'm not a Trump supporter. I reject both parties. I don't think either one supports the vast majority of Americans' interests. I just want to make that clear.
My guest is Joe Loria. We're talking about his article, How Russiagate Rationalizes Censorship, Consortium News, and much more, as you've heard. It's extraordinary things you have to say. We see recently what's happened in Honduras, the overthrow of an election, and we have Hillary Clinton very much involved in the coup back in 2009 against Zelaya, President Zelaya, in Honduras, in which she then said no way should he be allowed to come back to power in Honduras. And the United States was the only government in the Americas that didn't condemn the coup in Honduras. The United States said, well, it's not really a coup. And she defended this coup as being carried out along the laws of Honduras as if she knew anything about them. So we had a pretty horrible choice in 2016. And either way, we'd be on the threshold of war. Now we might be on the threshold of war with North Korea or even Iran. With Hillary, it would have been Russia, certainly.
Well, we don't know if they would have come to war, but she would have continued an aggressive stance and a dangerous one towards Russia, where an accident could happen, where things could have gone off the rails. And the only thing that Trump's ever said that's halfway decent is he wants a détente with Russia, and that a lot of people believe is behind intelligence agencies who leaked all this information after he was elected while during the transition to try to undermine him. And that is, again, behind the whole the Russiagate story, that they want to stop him from having better relations with Russia. Now, the intelligence agencies, since their inception, particularly the CIA, has been very close to Wall Street. It's people by people from Wall Street. Its role has been to support the elite and their interests at home and around the world. And these are the people that Democrats and supposedly left wing or progressive liberals are supporting and worshiping almost as the people who are bringing the truth about what happened, how Russia got Trump to be elected. They can't face what a horrible candidate Clinton was and how Trump was a very, very savvy liar, basically. He manipulated people into believing he was going to help them, people who were suffering enormously. He exploited their suffering, and he cynically manipulated them. And I think that's one reason he won. And now he's turning their back on them, as we see from this health bill that he tried to push and now this tax bill. So, yes, it was a horrible choice for both. And one of the things, by the way, that intelligence assessment had was that they decried that the RT had held a candidate's debate of the third parties, of the Libertarian Party, of the Green Party. I don't know if there were other people, and I didn't see it. But this was presented by the January 6th assessment as undermining democracy in America to present a debate of the third-party candidates. This is the thinking, to actually bring more democracy to Americans through a Russian media was considered to be undermining American democracy. And this is what Facebook says. They want to stop Russia from undermining democracy. And Eric Schmidt of Google said that Russia is using this as a weapon, their information. Yeah, a weapon against the elites in America. This is why they're trying to stop this. They don't, and they've got their careerists, journalists in the corporate media who go along with this because they have a stake in the system and they're only caring about their status and their job, and they are self-censoring or they don't know about this information at all. They don't care about it, and they see it when it comes from Russia as being, or a dissident website, as being propaganda. And it's unfortunately very successful right now, this campaign, to smear anybody who doesn't go along with the dominant narrative as being somehow a dupe or useful idiot of the Russians rather than an independent thinking person, like I'm sure a lot of your listeners are, Jeff.
Well, Joe Loria, one of the most extraordinary accusations made against the Russians was that Putin was trying to undermine America's faith in democracy. I don't know a single person who had any faith in our system, as if it would take Putin to do that. This, after the 2000 election, most Americans, most people I know, irrespective of their political position, have no faith in the American system, American democracy. It's lost a long time ago, and the idea of the Russians going to come along and undermine it by leaking some emails. And it's interesting also the fact that it's like a bait-and-switch situation. None of the hearings so far have produced anything to show there was a collusion between Russia between Putin and any of the Trump supporters before the election. Russia, it seems to me that Putin and his friends were doing business with Russian businessmen and suddenly had political overtones, but they would hire a British disc jockey to arrange a meeting in New York between Donald Trump Jr. and a Russian lawyer is preposterous. I mean, yes, go on.
They never delivered the opposition research. It was supposedly he was going there for opposition research on Clinton. It was never delivered as far as we know. And it's never been established that that's illegal to get opposition research from a foreign source. It has been theorized that that is something of value and that therefore equals a contribution in money from a foreign government, which is illegal, but that's never been established by a court by any or anyone. And if it is illegal, there's only one campaign in the 2016 election that did get opposition research from foreigners that we know of. That's the Hillary Clinton campaign from Christopher Steele's research and from his Russian sources that they paid for. So to accuse Don Jr. of something that he didn't even get, or George Papadopoulos, the low-level campaign guy of Trump who was indicted, who was promised sent emails about Clinton and never got them, apparently, because the indictment doesn't say that, and we never saw them, to accuse these guys. Now, Manafort then was then indicted for crimes he'd committed long before Trump even declared to be president. But that is spun in a way that still somehow proves this whole narrative of Russia's interference. Now, I don't doubt that there'll be more financial indictments by Mueller. It could even reach Trump himself. And maybe they'll get rid of him on that. But the idea that Russia was the one that put him in the office as some kind of Manchurian candidate is just very dangerous. And I think it goes on to these deeper political, geopolitical interests that I'm saying, and to try to squelch, to crush any dissident views inside the U.S. That's the real aim there by the intelligence agencies, apart from Trump, who may have been involved in a lot of shady stuff with the Russians and may have done things. I think that's why he's nervous about Mueller. And Mueller's going after the financial stuff. And then we've seen, Jeff, just in the last couple of days, an enormous amount of mistakes by the corporate media on this. And they just keep going on and on and on. CNN got the date wrong of the email from WikiLeaks to Don Jr. They said it was before the release of the emails, and they gave him a secret code to get them. And it was actually the day after. And we never hear any explanation how that could have been possible, that two sources at CNN and then two at CBS and two at MSNBC, if they were all different sources than these two, all got this date wrong on an email. We saw Bloomberg and the Wall Street Journal getting a story wrong that Mueller wanted banking records of the Trump family from Deutsche Bank. That's not true. We saw Brian Ross get suspended now for a week because he said that Trump had told Flynn to talk to the Russians during the campaign when it was actually after the campaign. If you remember, Jeff, from All the President's Men, that scene where Woodward and Burstyn get a story wrong and Ben Bradley screams at them because he said you shoot too high in an investigation like this and you miss, everyone you're targeting starts to relax. We've seen a slew of mistakes. Now, Woodward and Burstyn didn't make any more after that. But here it doesn't seem to matter. They keep making mistakes because they are a victim of their own mania that they've created about this. So somebody met a Russian. You're guilty. You know, somebody, the moment anything's to do with any kind of Russian contact with someone in the somehow the crime itself. There's no criminality here except perhaps financial crimes. That doesn't seem to matter. It has gone off the charts, this kind of hysteria that we're going through. And it's influencing people, like at the ACLU, in my opinion, at FAIR and ACLU and in academia. People are scared to talk. People are scared to oppose this story, to have no guts. It is chilling, very chilling.
You know, Joe, you mentioned the mistakes. The mainstream hears the lies, and when they make the errors, it's buried. And on Saturday's New York Times business section, it's buried in the business section. Is a headline says CNN corrects Trump story, fueling fake news claims. And they made so many errors on this, but the public doesn't hear the retractions. They remember right. The main story. And so
that's right.
You don't hear that NPR, Democracy Now. You don't hear them because the retractions are like they're small print. But these were major errors. It's the level of U.S. American journalism today is really at the bottom. This is sloppy reporting, and particularly on a story such as this, they have to be meticulous, but obviously they don't care or they're incompetent.
I think it's a whole bunch of stuff. I think that they care about getting this story out fast because this makes careers. This is the herd mentality. Writ large, we could see exactly what drives corporate media here. And when they're latched onto a story like this, you know, they've lost focus. They've lost perspective on what they're doing. And every little bit of information they think that could prove this either is completely wrong or is irrelevant. Look at the Flynn meeting. We heard for weeks this was going to be it. And that just proved collusion. Even after we found out that Flynn had asked the Russian ambassador to not impose retaliatory sanctions harshly on the United States. He did not go to him and say, okay, we're going to lift the sanctions because of something you gave us, because how you helped us to win. That's the allegation. There was never anything in that at all. And if the Trump administration wanted to lift the sanctions, that was their right as the incoming administration, as a policy. We heard about how during the Republican convention that somehow Manafort and others were influenced by Russia. Either some money was paid, never been explained, to change the platform, the Republican platform, that they wouldn't arm the Ukrainian government. That was Barack Obama's policy. There's nothing new about that. The right policy, too, by the way. So any whiff of some kind of contact between Russia and someone associated with Trump is whipped up into this frenzy of guilt. And we've got millions of Americans believing this, from foaming at the mouth new cold warriors like Rachel Maddow, for example, and a host of other journalists who have lost any sense of perspective or journalistic integrity or standards here in this particular story, because it makes their careers, it makes Maddow a huge amount of ratings. It's about ratings, about career, about being close to power. That's what corporate journalists like, to live vicariously through powerful people. So they're going to bring down a president that they think is the root of all evil in America, where he's a symptom of what's been evil in America for a long time. I don't know where this is going to end, but it looks to me, Jeff, that this is crumbling, this story. But that the Russian connection to overturn the election is becoming less and less the focus and more the financial crimes. But you know what? They'll just forget about that. And frankly, I hope that the Russia part gets out of that, unless there's real evidence, and I will believe it. I'm a skeptic, as I said, not a denier of this story. So if it comes out, but it's been a year and a half, and we haven't seen anything like this. We've just seen all kinds of maniacal false connections being made on things that are not illegal and that are meaningless in the end because there was some meaning somewhere. I just think that this story is collapsing. I don't know how you feel about that.
Well, they're milking it for all they can, it's all it's worth. But, you know, very quickly, I remember, as I did a program on it here, part of it, is Michael Flynn, one of his crimes was he was at head of the DIA, Defense Intelligence Agency, when that report was issued warning about the rise of Islamic State. And he went on an interview on Al Jazeera and talked about it and the role of Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama's administration in building the Islamic State. And I think that hasn't come up at all. But I remember this, and I was surprised that it hasn't. But obviously it's known. And I quoted from his interview on my program here. But there is so much out there that has been twisted and torn and compressed into a scenario that has people waiting. People I know, friends of mine, are waiting for Mueller. They're supporting Mueller. People who always question the U.S. government and its honesty and intelligence agencies, which have lied to us historically, are now believing the intelligence agencies suddenly. Everything is upside down since Trump's got elected. You know, day is night, night is day. And people who ordinarily would take progressive stands and defend people who are been censored and would support free speech are now the ones shutting it down. And that's
absolutely right.
That's extraordinary.
That's what Flynn said. He said it was a willful decision in Washington to support these radicals in Syria as a way to overthrow Assad. And he called that out. Now, I had a lot of problems with Flynn's Islamophobia and his obsession with Iran and his dangerous ideas about Iran. But he was right on that score. There's no question about that. And I also think he was wrong about what he did with Turkey in trying to talk about kidnapping Fethullah Gulen and taking huge amounts of money for that. But those things have nothing to do with the Russiagate story. This is the problem here. I think eventually they cannot keep this going. I really think the bottom's going to fall out eventually. But if they can get Trump on a financial crime of some sort, obstruction of justice, the guy did go on TV and tell Lester Holt that he fired Comey because of that Russia thing. So, I mean, and there could be other evidence, too. So I would not exclude that they're going to get Trump on obstruction of justice or financial crime or people close to him. But
Joe,
of that is moving further and further from Moscow.
Joe, we're going to have to stop it there. I I really appreciate it. I'm really glad we connected on this call, because I'm sure our listeners have their eyes opened by what you had to say, because they're not going to hear this any other place, unfortunately. Joe Loria, thanks for being our guest today. People can reach you at your address is Gmail. What, I have the address here somewhere.
Yeah, joeloria@gmail.com.
LAURIA.
You and Joe on Twitter. My articles appear on Consortium News. The one that we talked about is called House Russiagate Rationalizes Censorship.
Check it out, people.
I appreciate you having me on, Jeff. Appreciate you having
our,
me on.
Our pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Building Bridges.
Building Bridges with Ken Nash and myself, Mimi Rosenberg.
We're going to Mumia Abu-Jamal's new book party, which he curated, and the new book is Have Black Lives Ever Mattered?
Let's listen to Mumia himself as he spoke at his book launching about some of the issues he engages with in. We'll also hear from one of the greatest African-American authors and historians in the country, Dr. Gerald Horn, and the extraordinary activist, Pam Africa, Joanna Fernandez, Ash Williams, an activist of Charlotte's Uprising, and rap artist Immortal Technique, add their voices of enthusiasm.
My name is Johanna Fernandez. I'm part of the movement to free Mumia, and I am one of the founding members of the campaign to bring Mumia home. I'm also a professor of history at Baruch College of the City University of New York. We gather here at a propitious moment that more than ever needs to hear the lessons of the Black radical tradition. And we're here to celebrate the publication of a book by the former Black Panther and radio journalist who spent 28 years on death row and is now serving a lifetime of imprisonment without parole in Pennsylvania, Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Yeah!
He has just published a book, Have Black Lives Ever Mattered? I want to read a little bit from the book. Here's part of the dedication. To souls who shone brightly and were dulled by American hate, to those who struggle still, to the youth of America who dare to march, to yell, to stand on the simple principle that Black Lives Matter, I hereby dedicate this work. This work is essentially a series of vignettes written over the last 30 or 40 years since Mumia has been imprisoned. All of these vignettes are on the subject of police violence, the history of the police and its origins. There's a very important chapter in this book on another period in American history that was quite groundbreaking, the moment when the Black Panther Party decided that they would arm themselves to police the police in Oakland. Mumia brings us into the history of the past in order to explore not just the origins of the police and its problems, which he links to slave patrols, but he explores the shortcomings of reforms that have been put forth in this present period as a solution to police violence. One of the things he says is that video cams are essentially a sham, a way of getting people off the street, and essentially a reform that will do absolutely nothing for the problem of police violence. And part of what he does in the last chapter of this book is that he articulates the lessons learned by the Black Panther Party, but also the proposals of the Black Panther Party, not to create community policing, but to produce institutions in the community that have control over the police. So this is really a timely text that Mumia dedicates to the young people who have made police violence one of the most depressing and harrowing and tragic themes in American history, front and center in public discourse. Here you have a history of police violence and a history of policing in the United States that seeks to connect this generation of radicals, Black revolutionaries, and activists to a previous generation of Black radicals, activists, and people who fought for a different society. We need to learn the lessons of the past, but at the same time, Mia argues that the Black Lives Matter movement and all of the activists connected to it have to dream their own dreams and build a foundation upon which a different world will be built. However, he asserts that in order for us to really see an end to police violence, we have to really build for a revolutionary future in America and in the world. Revolutionary world in which Mumia walks among us. And in honor of Mumia, we have a special drink tonight called the Mumia Libre. So we invite you to celebrate with us. Without further ado, I'd like to introduce to you other members of the campaign to bring Mumia home, Tad and Sophia, who will be taking over. Thank you very much. And welcome.
I'm Sophia. I had the wonderful opportunity of visiting Mumia within the past 2 months.
Wow.
Yeah, we sat with Mumia. We broke bread with Mumia. We laughed with Mumia. We talked with Mumia. We fell into his innermost soul. You all should know that Mumia is like the light of any party. Even just having a conversation with him within that space where you feel confined and you have eyes watching you, about 17 cameras also watching you. At the end of the day, this is a party that he wanted for all of us. He said specifically that this is a party for the youth. But Mumia embraces everyone. He would be so elated to see all these beautiful faces with us here tonight. So another thing I wanted to bring up is the love that Mumia spoke about. He went back into the time when he was on death row for 28 years. And he said that for those 28 years, you would not imagine that living within a cell the size of your bathroom, how he felt so much love from not only his loved ones, but love from all of you. And that's what kept him alive for all that time. Let's also party for Mumia's imminent freedom, because yes, we're bringing him home.
Yes, right.
So, brick by brick, wall by wall, Free Mumia Abu-Jamal. Great, great. So he'll be calling in, and let's get this party started. Oh, Mumia.
Mumia.
Mumia's on the line, guys. Mumia's on the line.
Please call the State Correctional Institution immediately. Thank you for using Securus. You may start the conversation now.
I greet you all for coming out to our book party. I hope you love the book as much as I love writing it. So welcome, everyone. So there were some questions that I was given, and I'll try to address most of them right now. So then, whom did I write this book? I write books for everyone, but this was special. This was written for the young people who built a movement called Black Lives Matter. And I wanted this to be a sign the streets out of rage, despair, and shattered hope the last years of the Obama administration. So to someone like myself who has spent his life in the movement, to see the rise of these young people all across the country was more beautiful than anything in the world. Proof that black resistance still lives. And young black people and young allies of black people and young Latinos and young gay and lesbian and transgender people showed us what movements look like. They changed perception. So this is my response to them. I hope they all take it for what it is, a labor of love, a love letter to young people standing up. I was watching the news and I saw this young black woman get up with a sign in terms of mass incarceration. Hillary Clinton was speaking, and this person stood up in front of her, and everywhere Hillary turned, she moved the sign. It was so beautiful. It thrilled me, and I'm sure it thrilled millions of people, because here was a young black person speaking to the immense crisis of black and mass incarceration, to one of the architects of mass incarceration. Beautiful. And Ashley, you're my hero.
Thank you. You're my hero.
Well, you're my hero. I will never forget Black Wall with the sign. And it was, like, powerful. I love it.
Bumia, what does it mean to curate your party? Can you talk about your favorite things?
One of my favorite things is music. I love music. Yep. If you punch me, I'll sing. I love foods. Unfortunately, this is not the place to love foods, but even though I've been denied it for several decades, I still love it. For many years before I came into prison, I was a vegetarian. That meant, you know, celery, tomatoes, fruit, living foods coming from the earth. You get a lot of it in this joint. Do the best we can.
Would having a more progressive district attorney help you overturn your case? And two, what is the one thing that we can do to help you?
I think the answer to both questions is build a movement. Movements matter. In this state of American repression and the incarceral state, movements matter more than anything else. I'm in the middle of reading one remarkable book. I know many of you are aware of Kiyanga Mata Taylor. Professor Taylor wrote an incredible book called From Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation. She has put some work together, y'all. Let me just put it this way. I know that many, many people in black America, in our churches, in our schools, in our streets, I think this is the book that will spark a lot of more movement, because she really addresses the failure of the black intelligentsia, black elite, to address black oppression, the failure of the political class to address the terror and suffering and impoverishment and criminalization of black people. I urge you to read it. Let it spark movements, enrich activists so that they can move to the stage of becoming revolutionaries.
Talk about the connection between Palestinians and black Americans.
What we share is oppression in the United States and in Israel. Both states are settler states.
Say that.
Nations that stole land from people who lived there before them and claimed it for themselves. Before these states came into being, there were people living in those lands who were living a whole hell of a lot better than after they got. So when you think about Israel, think about a little American experiment. When you think about the United States, this is where it came from. Oppression on a grand imperial scale. Palestinians need freedom like black people in America need freedom. That's just real talk. I don't know, did you get the phone call today?
What was that?
The phone call.
No, I haven't
got
the phone
call. Okay. Hello? This is your president, the president. That's right. Donald J. Trump, President of the United States. Yeah. You believe that?
Yeah.
That's the most that I can hardly believe. It's believed almost a year. I said it's rigged, folks. It's rigged. Guess it was rigged, but for me. You believe that?
Yeah.
Believe. What's this? Who am I calling? Mumia's book party? Hey, get me out of here. I'm a roaster. Are you responsible for this? Oh, she's not there? She's been fired? Oh, God. All right. I know something was happening. Hey, listen, I'm out of here. I love you all.
Speaker, and Mumia spoke beautifully about Ash just now. Ash, Ash is a queer activist in Black Lives Matter and the Black Palestinian Solidarity Movement.
Wow!
Hails from Fayetteville, North Carolina.
Where's the outrage? I just want to say thank you to the folks who showed up tonight and to the campaign to bring Mumia home, for organizing this and for inviting me. I'm here because I'm outraged, right? Last year, I told Hillary Clinton to apologize to Black people for mass incarceration because I was outraged. And the way that I move my rage towards action is through direct action. Writing and I'm dancing at the intersections of direct action, embodiment, Afro-pessimism, and Black radical political theory. And I've read Mumia Abu-Jamal, and so when the campaign to bring Mumia home reached out to me about coming, I was enamored and I knew that I had to get here. And so I'm just so excited to be here, and I just want to say, do direct action. It doesn't matter what group that you decide to get down with, find somebody who agrees with what you believe in, and move towards action. I'm definitely all for rage's sake, but it's great when folks can move it towards action. There are so many opportunities to get involved here or wherever you live. Please turn up on the state. Please continue bringing attention to those who are wrongfully convicted, but any conviction, in my opinion, is wrongful. Please remember that while we're fighting for the wrongful convictions of other people, we also have to fight to end prisons altogether and free everybody who's incarcerated by them, and not just prisons, but detention centers, psychiatric institutions, and other institutions that hold the power down. I bring you greetings from Charlotte Uprising, where we're organizing to free a man named Raekwon Boram, who's being held accountable for killing a protester during Charlotte Uprising last year. We are trying to get Raekwon free. Please look us up on Facebook and support the work that we're doing down in Charlotte. Everyone there supports what y'all are doing here. So thank y'all.
We asked Mumia to curate this party. We wanted to be his eyes and ears in Harlem. And when we asked him, who would you like at the event, the first person he mentioned was Ash Williams. For me, this is a moment and a dream come true, because we launched the campaign to bring Mumia home 5 years ago in order to connect a new generation of activists, and Black activists in particular, with the movement to free political prisoners, and Mumia Abu-Jamal in particular. There are many political prisoners who are essentially veterans of the movement's last time, who sacrificed their lives, and they are behind prisons today. And we have recently heard that the FBI has the Black Lives Matter movement on their books. So the movement to free political prisoners is about defending our movements and our call for revolutionary change in America and in the world. Thank you very much for coming all the way from Charlottesville, North Carolina. Charlotte, North Carolina. Thank you.
This brother from day one has been out here supporting this cause. He's from Harlem, Immortal Technique.
Free Mumia,
free Mumia,
and free all political prisoners.
They got a new housing plan for the ghetto eventually. Projects for a new American century. False flag terrorism controlling you mentally, and the gospel in the hands of people with no empathy. A mixture of dangerous social chemistry between law enforcement and a military entity. Cameras on the corner of every corner you facing, testing out a future Gestapo on immigration, power, consolidation, information restricted, just like the iron law of oligarchy predicted, incarcerating the poor among the drug addicted, but not the families of the ruling class that's afflicted, cause it's a caste system like corrupted Hinduism. I think you should listen, I've been through the system in prison, I've been through religion, I carried the cross as a Christian for anti-disestablishmentarianism, until deceit and despotism arrested my vision, lyricism with cynicism and syllogisms, until they Pedro Albizu Campos and Dolby in prison, climate change conditions, chemtrails of Leo Strauss's philosophy, the birth of neocon policy, but I laugh at America's fear of a new world order controlling the hemisphere, cause our people been living that for the past 500 years. We gon' stop you bastards. Just stand and shop in the bag, you. Oh, we go. When I say free, you say Palestine. Free!
Palestine!
Free!
Palestine!
When I say Mumia, you say free him. Mumia!
Free him!
Mumia!
Free him!
Mumia!
Free him!
The love, I love y'all. I love y'all. Thank you so much.
Dr. Gerald Horn, can we get some... Brother's written more books than it would be wise to try to enumerate. This is the most recent book of his that I have. I'm sure it's not the most recent book that's out because this brother is an absolutely prodigious producer of work. But this book, everybody should try and get this book, The Counter-Revolution of 1776. I mean, it's fire. It's raw fire. This is a book that helps us to recognize that the paradigm in which we've been acculturated, in which we've been directed, is totally false, frankly. I mean, at least as regards the foundation, the origins of the United States. And so let's hear what he has to say. Dr. Gerald Horn.
It's an honor and a pleasure to be with you. Whether you folks know it or not, you're in the vanguard. Why are you in the vanguard?
Yeah.
Let me just turn to Mumia's book, where on page 149, he's speaking on Ferguson to the Rosa Luxemburg Conference in Germany in January 2015, because what the solidarity movement with Mumia exemplifies is what our movement in the United States needs now more than ever. That's international solidarity. And I think the important aspect of Mumia's book is not only the title, that is to say, How Have Black Lives Matter, but what he points out on page 33 when Mumia says, quote, the system kills blacks, there is no outrage. It has been normalized by centuries of white enslavement, terrorism, and injustice. Such violence is simply the accepted way of how things are. Unquote. I think what Mumia is getting at with those words is pointing out that we make a mistake. We ignore the history of slavery and Jim Crow, trying to understand the reality of the United States in 2017. Let me also say that if we are to free Mumia, if we are to defeat Trumpism, we have to exemplify what your committee is doing. Number one, exemplifying transnational solidarity, and number two, helping forge a broad coalition against white supremacy. So thank you very much. Free Mumia now. Free Mumia now. Free Mumia now. Free Mumia now. Forward never. Back never. Back never. Thank you very much.
And we have Minister of Confrontation with us, Pam Abbott.
On the move. Long live revolution. Let's tear this down. We all know about the commitment of Mumia, but we need to be like Mumia. Mumia is being ill right now. Mumia needs your help. The fact that Mumia is innocent and still in jail. They damn near killed Mumia 2 times last year. We didn't know what we was looking at when Mumia first got sick. He winded up itching from head to toe. His skin was encased in some black something. They said he had hepatitis C. We fought and got him the cure, although they said it will never happen. $1,000 a pill and all for 90 days, they said it will never happen. If you give it to Mumia, you won't have to give it to everybody. They said that Mumia no longer has hepatitis C. They say, we don't know. Mumia has a courageous doctor, Dr. Joseph Harris, who said that Mumia had hepatitis C. Through the movement, we wound up getting a judge to declare that what was happening to him was unconstitutional. Because of Mumia, men, women, and children throughout the United States can now get the hepatitis C. And at the point that they say no, presented with the lawsuit, Mumia, who is suffering because these people gave him the wrong medication and threw him into a diabetic coma. They gave him a drug called Otezla. Otezla, if you look it up, it causes brain damage, suicidal tendency, and a whole list of other things. Mumia last year was taking one. He's now taking 2 Otezlas a day. He had to grease himself down with Vaseline from head to toe. Could you pick that up when he was speaking to us? No, because Mumia's concern is everybody. You never once heard it from Mumia. But what we're saying is enough is enough. January the 17th, Mumia's case will be for another judge, former Supreme Court Justice Ron Castile. This smile that this brother had that you're looking at right now, when people see Mumia on a visit, they have no idea of how he's suffering. His feet burns. He said it feels like he's walking on glass. When he wake up in the morning, his shirt is red with blood from scratching all night. January the 17th, if you can be in Philadelphia, we need to shut it down. Be in Philadelphia on the 17th. Organize like you never organized before. Because Mumia has not wavered one bit. Not one bit. Living in the bowels of the belly of the beast. He has not stopped for us. We must celebrate Mumia and before the example that he set before each and every last one of us. Just think of this brother who's burning from the inside out and who's scratching from the head right now while he was talking to us. He was burning and itching. Mumia can't live much longer. Why he is under these conditions? We got to bring this brother out. There's enough information to campaign to bring Mumia home. When you're on the bus, talk about Mumia. When you're on the streets, talk about Mumia. When you're in your churches, talk about Mumia. Let's fight to bring this brother home. Down with this rotten ass system. On the move, long live revolution, January the 17th. In the street, on the move, on the revolution. Thank you, thank you.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
BC
see Barbados as a religious country, so it's not legal at all. Same-sex marriage or being gay is not right here in Barbados.
I was feeling a little scared, especially to be with my partner and to be so open after the election. Because, you know, I look very queer, and I'm not trying to hide that.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Our news wrap crew is off for the holidays. They'll be back in early January to update us on the latest news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world. On this week's special program, we get a glimpse of queer life on a conservative, Christian-dominated Caribbean island, and welcome back audiophiles Chris Wilson with some delightful words and music by Abby and the Myths. First up, thanks to Steffi Barnett and Shout Out Bristol, we learn about life for LGBT people on the North Atlantic island of Barbados. It's a British Commonwealth country and home to about 300,000 people. It's considered to be part of the Caribbean, however, and a major tourist destination. But religious oppression keeps most of its queer population hidden. Some have already found a safe haven in Canada. Here's Steffi Barnett.
The country, Barbados, and I've met up with Shem. Shem, what do you do for a living?
I'm actually a professional hairstylist here in Barbados.
Are you out on the island, or do you feel because of the prejudices within the island that you have to sort of stay hidden?
I wouldn't say that per se. I would say that I enjoy myself. I don't care what people think about me. So I just go and enjoy myself. If someone tried to bash me or whatever, I just ignore it.
Have you been party to homophobia?
Yes, it's a lot here in Barbados because we see Barbados as a religious country, so it's not accepted in Barbados. It's not legal at all. Same-sex marriage or being gay is not right here in Barbados. No, it's not.
What about trans, lesbian, bisexual?
Well, I would say we have two or three trans people here.
Would you say there was probably more, but just hidden?
Yes, there's probably more, but hidden, yes. But I found that now, since it's not accepted here, I found that most of my friends, everybody has seek asylum to move to Canada.
So Canada is seen as a safe place.
A safe place for them, yeah.
Is it an easy country to get into because of the persecution?
Yes, the positive persecution, yes.
Have you thought about moving?
Well, a couple of times, yes, I've been told, but since I have my salon here, it's hard to just go and start all over again. So yeah. I try my best to ignore it and just pull through.
Your customers, they're obviously accepting of you because they keep coming back to you. So how do they treat you? How are they with you?
They're very nice, actually. Very good. Very loving people. But of them, they have some husbands which they don't agree with it, so they...
Do you find that it's the men?
It's the men,
bigger problem than...
And I find it's the men and the older generation.
Are you with somebody?
No, I'm actually single right now.
Would you feel comfortable showing affection in Barbados to...
I don't mind, but as I said, I don't mind showing affection to my partner. But I find now if you do have a partner, the other partner doesn't want to show it because we know how Barbados could get. But for me, it's not a problem.
You're quite a strong character, aren't you, Sha?
Yes, I do have a strong character, yes. I really don't care what people think. They have some young gay people that were here and their parents put them out. They beat them, they cut them up with sharp, knives or whatever we call here. You guys might call it machete, but we call it a collins. And they're very abusive here. So sometimes if you see a group of men on the block here sees a gay man walking, they would take up a rock and just throw at you.
Wow.
Yeah.
So do you feel scared then when you walk in around?
Well, I will tell you this. I don't trouble anybody. I'm very peaceful. But if you come for me, I can defend myself.
do you know people that have actually been subject to that type of abuse?
Yes, a lot. There was about 5 or 6 people that I knew that were all targeted because they were gay, and they either one got shot in the hand, one got nearly their back, their whole shoulder sliced off. So they actually use that, because once you have the police report, as I said, you can go to Canada, and once you have the police report, you can seek asylum. You have to have, like, a police report or something, a witness or something stating that it's unfit for you to live here. And the Canadian government give them a grant, which allows them to give them a place to stay, send to school if they haven't finished school, and give them a monthly income to get on their feet.
How did you find growing up and, like, in family life when you were younger with your mum and dad?
Well, my mom still told me, Sham, I know you're gay, though. But with my dad, it took a while for him to get accustomed, but now we're good. He's fine. He wasn't abusive or nothing like that. He just didn't know how to maybe deal with it, I would say. But he would say, well, Sham, if this is what you are, I still love you as my son. But please keep it on low, because I don't want anybody to harm you or do anything to you.
I guess that was their biggest fear, wasn't it? That you'd be hurt.
Yes, but I really, to be honest, I didn't have a bad childhood with my parents or me coming out gay. They were more supportive than anything else.
And how about school? Was that difficult?
Well, school for me, I'm at school with all boys. So it wasn't a problem to me. I had some bullying, yes, but ain't nothing that I can handle.
So school was okay, you coped with that, yeah? Are there any societies or groups on the island where people of LGBT community can actually meet up?
Well, we do have parties. Like, we have a party for our crop over, which is our own carnival here in Barbados. We have one for Easter, we have one for Halloween, we have one for Christmas as well. All the seasons we have here, we have one. But it's more like a private something. Not everybody knows about it. It's a message you will send out and say, this is where the party is. But not like it's open for the general public. It will have to be around the same circle that we will know, well, this is a party coming up.
Yeah, so it's done very carefully.
Send a private message on Facebook or something. But it's nothing to open the public, because we're still afraid that, you know what, someone that isn't gay would find where the party is and just maybe kill or shoot all of us. So, yeah.
I guess the island needs people like you and the stronger ones to help others come up on the step.
I will say this. I'm strong, yes, but sometimes when we are attacked, the police are not even give us satisfaction of how we want it here.
So they're homophobic as well, the police?
Homophobic as well. Very, very homophobic. They don't care about you. You're like nothing to them, really. If you get in, somebody troubles you, they don't care. You take down the report and that's it. They don't even want to warn the person or tell the person something.
What about the lesbian community? Do you actually keep in touch with other groups within the LGBT?
We're all one group, the lesbians, the gays. We all party together. Yeah, we're not like there's a different section for gay women. We all come together.
Sounds good.
Yes. Yeah.
So those parties you have, it encompasses the whole rainbow.
The male and female LGBT community, yes.
Yeah. Do you keep in touch internationally with other Caribbean islands like Jamaica?
Not really. I have some friends in Trinidad that are gay. They do the same thing here. They keep it.
It's all kept quiet.
All kept quiet, and they keep it separate parties. Like, you only know the party if you get an invitation saying it's a party.
Shem, tell me about the politics of the island and the pressures from the UK on another Commonwealth country about the LGBT community.
Yeah, I remember the Queen asking the government here to, as we're a Commonwealth country, we still have a good relationship with the Queen. She asked us to legalize same-sex marriage here, and the government kicked up a big fuss about it. The Christians society here, the religion society and Christians kick up a big fuss about it, and they didn't pass it. But I find it very hard for the opposition leader, Mia Motley, on the BLP, the Barbados Labour Party. She is a lesbian. And
is she openly gay?
She's openly gay. She doesn't care. But they'd rather not give a woman maybe that is a lesbian that would do a really good job of ruling this country to get the current government out and give her a chance and let her spread her wings and bring back Barbados to what it used to be. They're just afraid that because she's a lesbian that she's going to legalize same-sex marriage. And I find they give her a very, very hard time.
Does she tend to be popular on the island, or is there...
She's loved by the BLP members. She's a very good person. She's a very good lawyer. She's a very good I can't remember the name. Is it economic? Right, economics, right. And she is really good at it. I think she would get back Barbados to the way it used to be. But as I said, she's made gay people would just not vote. They'd rather vote for the DLP, which is just mashing up the tourist side of Barbados, taxing us everywhere, and downgrading Barbados to the same level as Venezuela. And I think they should give her a chance.
It does seem very expensive on the island.
It is very. The cost of living is very, very high because this government, to be honest, does not know what they're doing.
Shem, thank you so much for chatting to me.
Thank you for having me.
Our thanks to Steffi Barnett and Shout Out Bristol for sharing that interview with us.
There's been a lot of noise in the air this year. You might even call it sound and fury. You can help defeat the noise by joining This Way Out's year-end campaign at thiswayout.org.
The latest album by singer-songwriter Abby Posner runs the gamut from folk to rock and even a little bit of country. Chris Wilson hosted her in our Los Angeles studios and her two-piece band, Abby and the Myth, to learn something about the artists and enjoy live performances of cuts from the album.
You are described in your bio as a tall, gorgeous lesbian, Buddhist, and multi-instrumentalist.
Yep, that's me.
And you brought somebody with you here today.
I did. This is the other member of my band. The band is called Abby and the Myth, and this is the lovely Kara Batema, and she plays accordion in the band.
Welcome, Kara. We're so glad to have you here, too.
Thank you for having me.
Do you suppose in a few minutes the two of you might give us a little taste of a live performance?
Absolutely. We would love that.
When did you first know that you wanted to make music, Abby?
I knew at a very young age. I was probably around 5 years old. I started taking piano lessons. And from there, I started taking guitar and drums and I fell in love with the arts and music at a very, very young age. I did a lot of theater as a child. I was always performing.
Now, you're originally from Colorado.
That's right. Yeah, I'm from Evergreen, Colorado.
And what brought you out here?
I came out here originally to study at CalArts, California Institute of the Arts, which is located in Valencia. I studied multi-instrumentation there at the musical arts program.
And even your first solo album, you played a number of different instruments and it was all you?
Yeah, I've released a few solo records where I played all the parts. I think I had a couple musicians come in and do some horns. I do not play any brass or woodwind, but I play a lot of the other kind of, you know, main rock instruments and banjo and mandolin.
Kara, did you come out from Colorado too?
No, from the Midwest, Indiana.
How did you become involved with Abby and the Myth?
We worked together at the same music store, and she started writing some of her solo music and was like, I think I really want accordion on this. And I'm like, oh, hey, I play accordion. And the rest is history.
It was about 2011 that Kara and I started collaborating. We've had a few different bandmates come, you know, in and out. It's been quite an evolution of sound. But Kara's been with me since I started the solo project. Yeah, it's been a long, long musical relationship. It's been really nice.
So now is it primarily your work with the band?
Yes, I've been in a lot of different bands. I was what we call a hired gun for a while. I was playing with some country artists and touring with a bunch of indie artists, but I started focusing all my energy on Abby and the Myth in about 2014. So that's been my main kind of baby.
Tell us about your latest release.
This record is called When You Dig a Well, which is actually the beginning of a quote from the Buddha.
I wondered about the title because very often an album title is the title of one of the songs, and I didn't see a song with that title.
Yeah.
So what's the rest of the quote? When you dig a well, then what?
The entire quote is, when you dig a well, there's no sign of water until you reach it. Only rocks and dirt to move out of the way. You have removed enough. Soon the pure water will flow. And I think that that can be interpreted in a lot of ways. But for me, that's kind of doing a lot of the internal work. My imagery is thinking of the rocks and the gravel as being some of the muck that you have to go through and some of the demons you have to face within. And soon, once you're able to calm and sit with yourself and do the muck of that work, the pure water flows. And I actually think the water in this case is a metaphor for some of the songs. Soon the lyrics will flow, the creativity flows. You don't have to be gripping so tightly on control and what music sounds like. Just let it be and be yourself. That's kind of how I imagine that.
Well, let's hear some music.
We're going to play for you a song called Delicate Parade, and this is the first song on the record. This song is about jumping over the hurdles of finding what real love is, because, you know, we all have our idealized forms of what love is from fairy tales and movies, and this is just kind of about really being with somebody for the good, the bad, and the ugly, and really being side by side with them.
I bring you water, cold and from my hands, climb the highest summit, barrel through the windy sands. I will tell you stories deep within my past, tales of smoky rivers, all the loves that wouldn't last. And there you are, standing in the sea, hair falling like rain. You are waiting there for me. And there I go, just stumbling and afraid. These feet are not worthy to march in your parade. Ah, 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 ah. I will let the light in when shadows come to rise. Cast away the demons and dance on their demise. I will show you seasons, to winter into spring. I laugh until we cry, when there is sadness, start to sing. And there you are, standing in the sea. Everything I've wanted, a long novel I have seen. And there I go, to weave. And there I go, oh, with the madness that I've made. It takes two hearts to march among this delicate parade. It takes two hearts to march among this delicate parade.
This is Chris Wilson, and my guests are Kate Batema and Abby Posner of the band Abby and the Myth. Abby, one of the things I found really interesting was your tour diary on your website.
It was the first time I'd ever traveled with a serious girlfriend.
And I also was doing the tour solo. Usually I've toured in the past with at least one other bandmate or a couple. And this was just me and her, and we crossed over about 25 states. The primary tours that I've done in the past have been the Northwest or the Southwest. So I did a whole East Coast, Southern. We crossed over a bit of the Midwest, played in my hometown in Colorado. The journey was just pretty incredible. I saw a lot of people from my past, met a lot of new friends, and that's kind of the beauty of touring is making connections.
In some of the places you went, though, you had a little trepidation about being perceived as visibly lesbian, visibly mm-hmm. non-gender conforming. Tell us about that.
Yeah, absolutely.
How did that go for you?
You know, it actually went really well, surprisingly. I've always had some insecurities about traveling through the South in particular, and I was feeling a little scared, especially to be with my partner and to be so open and after the election and just being harassed. I had a lot of fears because, you know, I look very queer. I am clearly a very queer person and I'm not trying to hide that. You know, I want to be myself and be authentic no matter where I go. And I used to travel with a lot of male musicians and there is a safety net there. Being two women, it's a little more vulnerable. But people really treated us with respect and care. And even my girlfriend noticed that there were rainbow stickers on like almost every cafe we went into.
The other story that I really enjoyed reading was your visit to the Stax Museum in Memphis and your dad's influence. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Because I like that story a lot, too.
Yeah, I feel like I just got a little emotional. My dad has been such a positive influence on me musically. He's not a musician himself, but he's more of a music historian and philosopher. And he is always the one that has turned me on to the soul music and the roots of blues and the roots of R&B and the influences that B.B. King, Sam Cooke, Otis Redding has on all of us. And I was so privileged to be able to go and see the journey of Otis Redding and to see some of the journey of Stax. Stax Records, for those of you that don't know, was one of the first record labels to integrate white and black artists. It just was a safe space. Not only was music a safe space, but the building was a safe space, literally. And so I look at Stax as being one of the very first kind of integration of white and black artists playing together. And I also look at those artists as being some of my, I just look up to them so much. They're my greatest idols.
Where can they go to find out where to see you or to buy your album?
So if you go to abbyandthemyth.com or Abby Posner, that's spelled P-O-S-N-E-R, abbyposner.com, you can go there. There's shows listed. And if you go to the merchandise, you can buy all the records online. We're selling them on Spotify, iTunes, Bandcamp. You can even buy vinyl. On our Bandcamp, we have vinyl.
Wow, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, we recorded this record, a portion of it on 8-track tape. So we wanted to make this as vintage and warm and kind of go back to the roots. Just like I was saying about Stax Records, kind of an homage to 8-track.
You know, I see the websites and the web presence of a lot of musicians, and yours is particularly impressive. You've got your SoundCloud set up, you've got your Facebook, you have your two websites. So there's a all you have to do is Google Abby Posner, and there you are.
Oh, thank you.
You've done a really nice job of that. And I want to thank you very, very much for being with us. I look forward to the next album. This has really been fabulous.
Thank you so much.
Oh, you're very welcome. I'm Chris Wilson. My guests have been Abby Posner of Abby and the Myth and Kara Batema. So let's hear just a little bit more.
All right, we're going to play a song called Who Have I Become? Again, this is from the record When You Dig a Well.
Oh Lord, darkness, where have you been? I see you lifting your lies and raising your head. You've been fighting heat like a burning flame. And I know you'll be running back again. But I will fold up my pride with the evening brushing up against my side. I will hold the hand of God. If she looks me in the eye, see who I've become. Who have I become?
Oh, preacher, preacher, don't sink my stones. Won't you straighten my back and heal my bones? And way out here, you never feel lost. Like a lone wolf howling at a broken cross. But I will fold up my pride with my hands in the air and the mist in your eyes. Take me far away from here. Won't you loan my gun? Won't you cage my fears? You never fear. Turn to rust, but I will fold up my pride with the evening brushing up against my side, and I will hold the hand of God. If she looks me in the eye, see who I've become. If she looks me in the eye, see who I've become. Won't you look me in the eye, see who I've become? Who have I become?
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Steffi Barnett and Chris Wilson contributed program material this week, with a tip of the hat to Steve Pride. Abby and the Myth performed most of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks to Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener donors, for making this program possible, especially during our Defeat the Noise year-end campaign at thiswayout.org. Look for This Way Out Radio on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google+. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappelle and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Holiday greetings from all of us to you and yours, and thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org, across Europe, Africa, the Middle East, and the Asia-Pacific region, on the London-based World Radio Network, and on more than 200 local stations in the U.S., Canada, Australia, New Zealand, the U.K., South Africa, and India, including this community radio station. Stay tuned during your happier new year. Thank you.
studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. According to right-wing libertarians and free market economists, the unfettered market leads to freedom from domination. And there's no better expression of such freedom than the private enterprise. My guest today, philosopher Elizabeth Anderson, believes such notion couldn't be further from the truth. In her book, Private Government, How Employers Rule Our Lives and Why We Don't Talk About It, published by Princeton University Press, Anderson argues that in the workplace we have almost no rights. She's professor of philosophy and women's studies at the University of Michigan. Before we turn to the workplace, Elizabeth, let me start by asking you about the history of ideas celebrating the free market, which we associate with the libertarian right. You argue that they had more egalitarian origins in the 17th century, in the very early days of capitalism in England. Tell us about that history.
Yes, exactly. So I trace free market ideas back to the levelers during the English Civil War, which happened around the 1640s. The levelers, as you could guess from their name, were an egalitarian group, although they didn't believe in leveling down as we understand it today in terms of the equal distribution of property. But they did believe in equalizing privileges. So the levelers argued against the House of Lords. They wanted to abolish aristocratic privilege. They wanted to abolish the monopoly that the great landowners had over land in those days. Inheritance of land was based on primogeniture and entail. These were laws that said that the great estates could not be broken up into smaller estates and sold off on a free market, but rather the estate would be passed down whole to the firstborn son of each aristocratic family. So there was a monopoly on land that was held by the lords, and then there was a monopoly on trade that was basically bought by the great manufacturers. And all the small craftsmen had to do the bidding of the big manufacturers in these guilds. It was really the big shots who made all the rules about who could trade, where and when they could trade, how much they could trade, what prices and so forth. And obviously those rules were all rigged in favor of the big manufacturers. And an ordinary small producer really had no recourse but to follow the rules that the big shots held. And so from their point of view, breaking up monopoly and opening up trade to anyone who wanted to participate was a huge egalitarian advance. It leveled the playing field between large and small manufacturers, between yeoman farmers and great landlords. And most importantly, it would open up opportunities for self-employment to large numbers of people. So the levelers were vividly aware that the employment relationship in those days, it was called the relationship of master and servant, was a relation of domination between the masters who were superior and who could order around the inferiors. And levelers such as Lilburn and Hewell argued that if you opened up trade, free trade, to everyone, that lots more people could become self-employed. They'd be their own bosses. They wouldn't have to answer to someone who lorded it over them. And so that would result in a general liberation of the working classes.
So the key thing here then is that when they were thinking about work and the conditions of work, they were picturing people who were working for themselves. Is that right?
That's what they were hoping that the free market would deliver. And you can see that theme, that opening up free market and free trade would open up opportunities for self-employment, carried forth continuously through other free market thinkers, including Adam Smith, the great author of The Wealth of Nations and a great founder of classical economics, Tom Paine, the great American revolutionary, you can see this theme of self-employment all the way up to the eve of the Civil War, promoted by the Republican Party and its leader, Abraham Lincoln. They all thought opening up for free trade would enable everyone to be self-employed, or at least dramatically expand the ranks of the self-employed. And so the employment relation would just shrivel to a tiny marginal affair that people, maybe when they just started out in life, they would be a farmhand or a servant for a couple of years, but very rapidly acquire enough savings so that they could set themselves up in business for themselves, mostly in farming, but they might become professionals or craftspeople as well.
So what then happened? What was the reality as market society took hold, as capitalism developed from the 17th century, when we were talking about the levelers, to the emergence of the Industrial Revolution?
Right. So the big thing that happened, why don't we roll back a little bit and think about Adam Smith's argument, because his argument was really pivotal from an economic point of view. He argued that the great landlords were actually very inefficient at farming because they couldn't be bothered with the details. The great landlords, they're aristocrats, they're busy consuming luxuries and holding balls. But they were not good businessmen because they didn't, you know, they had a monopoly on land, and so the rents were just pouring in without them having to lift a finger. He thought that they were lazy and stupid and were not able, not inclined to attend to the kind of details needed to increase efficiency of production. The manufacturers were all monopolists, and so while they were pretty crafty and smart, they really wanted to just collect monopoly rents rather than improving efficiency of production. So on Smith's view, if you broke up the monopolies and you forced people to compete, the natural unit of production would be the self-employed business person, because that person would have a huge incentive to work very efficiently the capital that they owned. The yeoman farmer, who just owned his own family farm, had a far greater incentive to invest carefully in the land and work it efficiently than landlords or slaves or tenants who had to, or sharecroppers who had to pay half of everything they grew to the landowner. The person who had the greatest incentive to work hard and efficiently would be the person who got to keep 100% of the fruits of his labor. And that would be a self-employed person. The employee didn't really have that much of an incentive to work hard and efficiently, because a certain portion of the fruits of the employee's labor would go to his employer. So why work hard? The whole argument depends on the background assumption that economies of scale don't really make much of a difference. There are not really big economies of scale, and indeed, Smith argued that quite explicitly. He said there were only a few cases in which economies of scale, where you need massive concentrations of capital to get the enterprise going, mattered. He pointed out, well, maybe canals were like that. You build a canal, it takes a lot of investment. So there are economies of scale with canals. But he said, precisely for that reason, it's very routine business. It really didn't matter whether you had private enterprise or whether you had the government running a canal. You'd land in the same place. So he thought, yeah, there's a couple industries where maybe you had economies of scale, but the rest, it was the self-employed worker who had the greatest incentive, who would work the hardest and the smartest. And so under free market competition, capital ownership would devolve to the self-employed business person. Everybody would be self-employed. Everyone would only own enough capital that they could work with their own hands, and maybe a temporary worker or two who would then go on to build their own enterprise. So all enterprises would be small, and that meant that wealth would be roughly equally divided among everyone, and that everyone would be free and equal because they wouldn't have to answer to a boss. That was the picture, and the Industrial Revolution is what destroyed that picture. because you have giant spinning factories, and then later on in the second half of the Industrial Revolution, you have giant iron foundries and so forth. These are huge operations. Railroads, they required huge agglomerations of capital far beyond the capacity of any single worker to accumulate. And once you get huge scale, you need many hands to work these large concentrations of capital. So it's inevitable that you end up with an employment relationship where you have a few capital owners who are really rich, they own the enterprise, and they hire the workers. So what the free market ultimately delivered was a massive degradation of the standard of freedom of the worker, because now the workers were even deeper under the thumb of their employers than before. So the free market prediction of pre-industrial revolution theorists got turned on its head, and inequality just expanded rather than contracting under the free market.
How did that affect free market thinking then in the 19th century when clearly the predictions turned out quite differently? Did it change the ideas that people who had been celebrating the free market held?
Well, at that point, then, free market thinking kind of diverted. So in the 19th century, what you get is, with the notable exception of John Stuart Mill, a move towards a kind of rationalization of the domination of workers by their employers at the hands of theorists from Thomas Malthus to Herbert Spencer. And you had the great era in the 19th century of class conflict. So on the one hand, you had the pro-capitalists who became quite anti-egalitarian and basically said, you know, the poverty and subordination of the workers was socially necessary, desirable, and just what they deserved. And then the left basically ended up rejecting the market, and it moved over to the labor market, to revolution under Marxism or various forms of socialism or the organization of labor unions. And the one holdout was John Stuart Mill, writing in the mid to late 19th century. He was the last of the great classical economists. And what he hoped would result from the Industrial Revolution was workers being able to collect into cooperatives and collectively own and manage the firm. And that was a hope that he had, that workers would all prefer that arrangement. But in the end, that arrangement was a very marginal thing in the 19th century. And a large part of the cause was just that the amount of capital that had to be raised in order to own a competitive firm just far exceeded the capacity of ordinary workers to save up for.
That's the voice of philosopher Elizabeth Anderson. We're talking about her book, Private Government, How Employers Rule Our Lives and Why We Don't Talk About It, published by Princeton University Press. I'm Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So then, taking things up to the present, where obviously, free market ideas are the ideas of the right, especially the libertarian right. And following those ideas, not only does the free market perpetuate freedom, it perpetuates freedom through these different enterprises, private enterprises, which are crucial units within a market system. You, on the other hand, make the argument that our places of employment, workplaces, are not the realm of freedom, but quite the opposite. Tell us why that is.
Yes. So even if you go back to the levelers, they recognized government. And they thought that government was everywhere. You have government wherever you have some people issuing orders to other people that they can back up with sanctions for disobedience, carrots and sticks, over some domain of activity, more or less unified domain. So the levelers were vividly aware that husbands governed their wives, that school teachers governed their pupils, that employers governed their employees. It was at the hands of the master that the journeymen worked. They took orders from the master, and if they performed poorly by the master's judgment, then they would be punished. Their wages could be docked. And indeed, back in those days, and indeed all the way up in America until the mid-19th century, workers were paid at the end of a year. They were under contract for an entire year. And the employer had the right to withhold any or all wages for 365 days for the slightest infraction of any work rule in any single day. So a worker who failed to show up on day 365 or failed to absolutely obey the stringent instructions or turn in work of lesser quality than expected for just one day could have all 365 days of wages docked.
Astounding.
Imagine that. So it didn't mean that workers starved, because in those days, workers lived in the household of their employer. There was really no other way, because transportation just took too long. So you had to live nearby your employer, and most of them lived in the household of their employer.
That sounds like a very complicated arrangement. And then in our times, with a modern industrial firm, what rights do we give up when we enter into an employment relation?
Right. So I've just characterized the employment relation as a governance relationship where bosses govern workers. And that's just as true today as it was back then, although we're lucky enough now to live in houses that are separate from our bosses. So at least when we're off work, most of the time our employers don't meddle with us. However, under contemporary employment law in the United States, the default rule is something that's known as employment at will. And employment at will means that your boss can fire you for any or no reason at all. And there's only a tiny number of exceptions to the employment at will rule. Most of those exceptions having to do with discrimination. So your boss can't fire you because of your race, your gender, disability status, age, and so forth. There's only a tiny number of reasons why you can't be fired, but the employer can fire you for any other reason, or just because, you know, the employer just gets angry, or, you know, just had a stomach ache, right? Some arbitrary non-reason and fire someone just in a fit of pique. Now, what that means is, under employment at will, that in fact, workers cede virtually all of their rights to their employer, because their employer could fire them for any kind of reason that they just don't like about the person. And that could even extend over into their private conduct. So you get off duty, and maybe you do something that the employer doesn't like. For instance, maybe you have a same-sex partner, or maybe you go drinking with your friends and your boss is a teetotaler and doesn't like that. Well, you could be fired for that. Any kind of private conduct, even off duty, is subject to firing at the hands of the employer. And of course, on duty also, there's very minute control that bosses exercise over their workers in many workplaces. So in the research that I found, we have some pretty outrageous cases. Turns out that most of the poultry workers in the United States, these are the ones who work in the slaughterhouses, are not allowed to use the bathroom for their entire 8-hour shift. When they complain, the boss just tells them to show up at work wearing diapers.
That is astounding. And these workers, are there no labor laws about them having breaks sometime within those 8 hours?
Well, according to OSHA, the Regulatory Workplace Safety Agency, Every employer has to supply a bathroom. However, they don't have to supply enough bathrooms so that everyone gets a chance to go to the bathroom on break. And indeed, it's taken so long even to get the right to have a bathroom that OSHA took a long time after that to issue a regulation that once the bathroom was there, workers had a right to use it. And that right is still widely disrespected in a number of industries, including slaughterhouses.
Are there differences of the degree to which domination is exercised against workers depending on status and pay? I'm thinking upper middle class professionals work many, many hours, but their conditions of work may be different than people who are in lower paid, say, service sector jobs.
That's an excellent point. So you are right that the professional managerial class is in many of them are working all the time. I can speak for personal experience. I'm chair of my department. Basically, I have no leisure anymore. All of my work, right? You know, there are so many demands on me just as an academic administrator now chairing my department that there's almost no time to do to have any leisure at all. So that's a very common phenomenon for the professional managerial class. They got to bring salaried workers. They bring work home with them. They have to be on email all the time. However, I'm not going to shed too many tears for the upper tier of workers because they also get a lot of prestige, a lot of autonomy, meaningful work, high salaries, benefits, and so forth. So I'm not complaining on my own behalf. Much worse conditions are faced by the mass of lower paid workers. Let's keep in mind that the median individual salary in the United States, or annual wage, is about $30,000 a year. So we're talking about people who are financially straitened. And what that means is they really have to put up with mountains of abuse because they don't have the kinds of mobility options that most members of the professional managerial class have.
Right, because one of the things that could brought up here is, well, if you have a job where your boss is a jerk or it's oppressive, you know, go find another job. Why can't you just do that? Why is that not the answer?
Well, you could take a look at restaurant workers, people who serve tables. 90% of them have experienced sexual harassment at work. Okay, so what restaurant are you going to exit to? Even if by chance you land in one of the 1 in 10 restaurants where people haven't yet experienced sexual harassment, that gives you no security at all that tomorrow your boss might not decide to sexually harass you. That's what the system is like. The form of government of the workplace isn't just any ordinary government. It's a dictatorship. It's arbitrary government. The employer can do pretty much anything to you, and your only recourse is to quit.
Well, let me ask you more about sexual harassment. Obviously, women can harass men.
Yes.
And it's not just men who can harass women, but clearly in the recent wave of people coming forward and talking about being harassed, often it's not described as a labor issue, even though a lot of these things are taking place where someone has domination over another person. You state that the authoritarian power of employers has roots in patriarchal rights over the household preceding the Industrial Revolution, and then it moved from the household to the firm. Does that leave any legacies? Is there any connection between the two, or am I making a big jump there?
No, you're completely correct. So traditionally, because workers, the journeymen and the apprentices lived in a kind of extended family of the household, and same with butlers and all kinds of domestic servants. And even tenant farmers lived on the great estates of the landlords, and the landlords treated them as really part of their household and under their dominion as patriarchs. So you're completely accurate about that, and that was part of the ideology of patriarchy, of course, is that the the head of the household, you know, has arbitrary rule over all subordinate members of the household, his wife, children, servants. You could read this directly in John Locke. Locke actually, ironically, opposed that. He was a feminist of his day, and he thought that wives didn't really have to knuckle under their husbands, except for a small number of areas. But the norm was that subordinate members of any household had to knuckle under, and that's what patriarchy was all about. And ironically, even after the Industrial Revolution separated the place of work from people's homes, you know, where they slept and ate, those traditional patriarchal norms and understandings of the authority that the employer had over the worker kind of continued without much change. Workers gained a few rights, but a lot less than you might expect, because those old assumptions that the boss got to govern the worker continued. So you could look in the early days of the Industrial Revolution in the United States, when Henry Ford adopted his famous high wage rate for assembly line workers for his cars. That wage rate was tied to workers exhibiting good behavior. And he established something known as the sociological department, which was kind of a human resources department that would actually visit the workers' homes to make sure that they kept them neat and clean, that they used the bathtub correctly, that they ate American food, not European-style food, because many of them were immigrants, that they didn't send too much of their wages to their family members who were still abroad. They had huge numbers of regulations for how workers ought to behave in their private lives.
You know, one might think Henry Ford was a bit of a nut, and that kind of control seems so hard to imagine. But you're arguing that actually contemporary employers do affect our personal lives and our work lives in ways that I think a lot of us don't spend much time thinking about, or thinking of being the result of a particular arrangement and a particular relation of domination and subordination. And earlier you gave some examples, but of course, political activities are something that you could get fired
yes.
over.
Yes.
Not so, exercising would be another.
Right. So one of the things that's happened is employers now are acting as public health authorities over their workers. Under the Affordable Care Act, there were certain changes that were made in regulation of employer-covered health care plans. And one of them was that workers could suffer a 30% surcharge on their monthly health insurance premium if they did not join an employer-sponsored wellness program. Those wellness programs often involve diet programs, exercise, smoking cessation, require workers to reveal personal details about their lives, such as whether they use birth control or plan to have children or have sexual dysfunction. Do you really want to be revealing that kind of information to your employer? I think it's none of the employer's business. But as a de facto public health authority, they're entitled to force workers to divulge that kind of information.
And yet, these sorts of intrusions are so pervasive that it seems like a lot of people don't actually question them and question the arrangement.
Yeah. I mean, they kind of just accept that this is what you got to do in order to get a job or remain employed. Here's another example. A huge percentage of workers in the United States are subject to pressure from their employer to contribute to political campaigns or political action committees that are run by the corporation or favored by the employer. My husband, who's a physician at Henry Ford Health System, a giant, a sprawling healthcare system with multiple clinics and hospitals in Southeast Michigan, he gets pressured every campaign season to contribute to the political action committee of his employer. He's told how, you know, what causes are favored by the employer and which candidates and so forth. And he feels a certain degree of intimidation. A lot of professional managerial workers, but even hourly workers are pressured in this way, sometimes to show up at campaign events to ostensibly support candidates that they might not really support. And they feel, many of them feel intimidated because if they don't show up, is this going to be a mark against them? Campaign contributions are traceable by anybody. They're a matter of public record. The employer could check up and see whether an employee has made the contributions that were encouraged by the boss. It's a very intimidating thing.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Today, I'm speaking with Elizabeth Anderson. She's professor of philosophy and women's studies at the University of Michigan. We're discussing her book, Private Government, How Employers Rule Our Lives and Why We Don't Talk About It. That's published by Princeton University Press, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. And I'm Sasha Lilly. So I want to ask you, given all the things that you've been enumerating take place in our workplaces that you argue allow for a tremendous amount of domination in the workplace to the point that you're labeling the workplace a private government, what allows the state of affairs to happen where workers cede most of their rights when they take a job?
It all comes down to employment at will. If your employer can fire you for any or no reason, your employer can issue pretty much any order he or she wants to you and threaten you with, if not firing, then demotion, pay cuts, harassment, abuse, any form of intimidation that will get you to comply with the boss's preferences.
So would you argue then that workers who are not at-will employees are not governed by their bosses?
So the government remains, but say you are represented by a labor union, then you have someone to complain to and your union rep can bring up complaints. You get some procedural protections against arbitrary handling and abuse. I'm not saying labor unions are perfect, but they certainly give workers a voice and some representation in the firm. And so workers represented by unions are less subject to abuse and domination than those who are not.
Right. But of course, particularly in the United States right now, very few people are in unions. And even within a union, you'd be constrained by the terms of the contract.
That's quite correct. And, of course, unions do have their problems. So we do know, for instance, that it's been very difficult even for workers represented by a union to get any recourse if they suffer sexual harassment at the hands of coworkers. That's been a big problem. There's a lot of sexism in unions. Not all unions. Some of them are actually really outstanding on these issues, but some of them are pretty problematic.
But nonetheless, very few people in the United States are represented.
Correct. That's right. And that is a product of our laws regulating the formation of unions. And we have, there are different rules in different countries. So if some countries, people get the protections of labor union contracts, even if they're not a member. In France, for instance, the rates of unionization in the private sector are not much higher than in the United States, but collective bargaining takes place on an industry-wide level, and consequently, even workplaces that have no union get some of the benefits of collective bargaining that is undertaken by a small percentage of unionized workers. So there are lots of countries that have a regime like that. Now, there are pluses and minuses of that kind of regime, but it shows you that in some places, even with small percentages of people in unions, they can get a lot of leverage on behalf of workers generally. In the United States, the labor law is written in such a way that unions are pretty much confined just to bargaining within their unit, which could be very small.
Indeed.
Why have struggles over the length of the workday been crucial to the struggle over worker domination within firms?
That's a really great question. If we go back to the 19th century, the biggest issue in the workers' movement in the 19th century was not wages. It was the length of the working day. When you had people who had to work 12 hours a day, you could imagine they had barely enough time to get up, eat breakfast, drag themselves to work, work a whole shift, go home, catch a quick bite to eat, and then fall asleep so that they would have enough energy for the next day. They had no leisure at all. They were under the thumb of their bosses at work pretty much their entire lives. And so if you look, for instance, in the United States, and there were similar movements all across Europe, the Knights of Labor, late 19th century labor movement organization in the United States, called for an 8-hour working day. And their slogan was, you have 8 hours of work, 8 hours of rest, and 8 hours to do what you wanted with yourself. That was freedom, right? Finally, you get a chunk of the day where you actually have the leisure, the freedom, and the energy to do with that time, with that big chunk of your life, what you wanted to do with it. It's liberation.
Do you think that struggles over the length of the workday could be an important fight around the questions you're talking about the ways that workers' lives are dominated by their employers?
Well, today I think the struggles over the timing of work have shifted somewhat. It is true that the professional managerial class is working all the time, and that's definitely an issue for them. But I'm thinking more about hourly workers and the uncertainty of the hours they get from week to week. So a huge percentage of hourly workers cannot count on full-time work from week to week, and they don't even know what hours they're going to get until, you know, a little bit ahead of time. It makes it impossible for them to plan their lives. It could be that they're called for a few hours in the morning and then they're let off with no pay for several hours in the afternoon. But if they have a long commute, it means they can't really spend any leisure back home. They're hanging around with junk time on their hands that isn't paid, with nothing to do, no friends and family nearby to enjoy it with. And if they have shifting schedules from week to week, it means that it's almost impossible to schedule care for their children. Because then their caretakers would have to shift from week to week, and maybe that's not possible. It also means that they can't plan for higher education. You can't sign up for a college course and pay all that tuition and then find that your boss has decided that the hours that your class is meeting, your boss wants you to show up and work. So the fluctuating hours, the uncertainty of wages, fluctuating income, lots of junk time, inability to plan ahead for regular child care, for leisure time, for college classes or other forms of self-improvement, right? All those opportunities get shot because of an uncertainty in the scheduling of work.
What role does the state play in this state of affairs where workers are dominated by their employers at work?
That's a really important issue because, according to free market ideology, the theory goes, well, this is just a free contract between the worker and the employer, and they could tailor it to the terms that are mutually acceptable to both parties. But that forgets that the state plays a critical role in defining the default contract of the workplace, which is employment at will. It's the employment at will regime that hands enormous amounts of arbitrary power to the employer. And it's the state that rigs the game in this way. The employer holds all the power cards, all the authority cards. And so if you hand one party all the cards and the other party now has to enter a negotiation, What are the chances that the employer is going to deal cards to the worker? Well, for a few highly talented, very scarce workers, maybe they will get a few cards. But for your ordinary, easily replaceable worker where there's dozens of people in line to get that job and hundreds of applications to sort through, the employer just figures they're going to offer the lowest possible terms with the least amount of freedom. And workers just have to put up with it because they have to eat and take care of their families. So the state is ultimately responsible for the form of the contract and the default form of governance in the workplace. And it's the state that's decided that the form of government of the workplace is a dictatorship where the employer has arbitrary power over the employee, not only on duty, but even off duty.
Elizabeth Anderson is my guest. We're talking about her book, Private Government, and I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. How does looking at the place of work, as well as this longer history that you've traced about how the proponents of the free market have seen the workplace, how does it change our understanding of domination? Because much of the discourse about domination and freedom in this country does not include workplaces at all. The way that they are framed is that, especially particularly on the right, is to do with freedom from the state. So do you think that we should be sort of upending our that understanding of domination?
Absolutely. So what I want to argue is that when we talk about government, most people are just talking about the state. And what I'm arguing is, and this is an argument explicitly directed against libertarians, libertarians talk that way because their ideology was formed before the Industrial Revolution. It was formed at a time where they anticipated that the upshot of completely free markets, the upshot of abolishing all monopoly, would be that the state would be the only remaining form of government because everyone would be self-employed. They'd be their own boss. They wouldn't have to take orders from an employer. That prediction did not pan out. But libertarians in their rhetoric never updated their beliefs to reflect that. So they remain narrowly focused on the government of the state, and they rail against government and arbitrary government and how it restrains our liberties. But they fail to recognize that the scope of government lies far beyond the state, and it includes the workplace. So my argument to libertarians is, if you're skeptical of government and the way it constrains our liberties, you ought to be skeptical of the employment relation, which is another kind of government, which, unlike our state, local, and federal government, is not democratic. It's a form of government where the people being governed don't have any voice. They don't have a right to a voice or a vote, right? It's undemocratic. It's a dictatorship. This is what I call, this is what I call private government. It's government that's kept private from the governed, in the sense that the governors say it's none of your business what orders we give. So it's private from the people being governed, and I think that's objectionable.
Well, thinking about the private enterprise, the workplace, as a place where a kind of governing takes place, aside from making the change that people would not be at-will employees who would be subject to being fired with, you know, no recourse, are there other changes that could happen at the level of the workplace? I mean, you've mentioned unionization, but I'm talking about actually within the structure of the workplace that would address this problem at its root, because it seems like you're arguing that people need to have more leverage, workers yep. within a workplace, they need to have more leverage, say, through a union, trying to limit the power of the employer over them. Is there
right.
some deeper way, though, that the whole workplace relationship could be reconfigured?
Yes. So what I argue in my book is that it's time to rethink the constitution of government of the workplace. Labor unions have their place, but one of the defects of labor union law in the United States is workers have to put the union up for an election, right? There has to be an election to be represented. And that opens up the scope for all kinds of intimidation. And some companies just shut down any part of the workplace where the workers have decided to unionize. So it turns out that it's very difficult to establish a union. And even if it is elected, workers just ignore it with impunity. And it's very difficult to force them to bargain in good faith. So my view is we should look over to Europe, which has an alternative system that runs parallel to labor unions. And many of these countries have a system that's known as co-determination. Under co-determination, the constitution of government of the workplace is fixed in advance and automatically includes representation of workers in the management of the workplace. As soon as a workplace gets to be 50 workers or more, workers automatically get a representative that has a hand in management. So they're not just bargaining externally for wages and benefits. They're actually part of management, and they make managerial decisions jointly with representatives of the owners of the firm. And I think that could do a lot to protect workers against abuse, even if they're not represented by a labor union. They'll still have a voice in management, which can call out bosses for, you know, all kinds of abusive behavior and say, you know, you can't do that. And indeed, some of the managers will be workers, that is, representatives of workers, accountable to them. So they're going to have a strong reason not to impose harsh and abusive conditions.
But going a step further, since your work focuses on these social relations of power, what about doing away with the distinction between bosses and workers? What about workplace cooperatives? How about that as another model?
Sure. I mean, look, it would be great if we could have more worker-owned and operated cooperatives. That was John Stuart Mill's hope. My point of caution is it's not obvious that we can pull that off for a lot of workplaces. For some workplaces, the scale of the enterprise is simply too vast for workers to actually own it. Think about huge things like universities and hospitals and airlines. It's really hard to figure out how workers could collect enough capital to actually own the enterprise, or a giant hotel or casino or something. They're just too big. And even if they could gather enough capital to own the enterprise collectively, it's probably not a prudent investment to put all your eggs in one basket, both your employment eggs and your savings eggs. If that enterprise were to go bankrupt, the workers would be left penniless without either a job or any savings to fall back on. So it's not obvious to me that the worker cooperative, I mean, it sounds really great, and there are some successful ones, and I wish them well. But it's not obvious to me that that really is the best setup for workers. And that's why I think something like co-determination could make a lot of sense and is worth bringing over from Europe to the United States.
It seems like in discussing the workplace itself, where, you know, market societies were distinguished by things becoming commodities, including labor. So you sell your labor to an employer as a commodity. Do you think that is at the crux of the problem, whether or not that could be changed fundamentally, being a separate one?
Well, I think there is a classic critique of the employment relationship, which is based directly on commodification, because once people become commodities, you know, maybe they're not owned as in slavery, but they're rented, and then they lose all their liberty. Mm-hmm. However, under a system of co-determination, that really amounts to substantial decommodification of the employment relationship, because then workers have a guaranteed voice in management, so they are, to that extent, self-governing. And there's all kinds of work rules to protect workers against abuse, to protect their privacy and autonomy, both on and off the job. It looks less and less like a form of commodification and more an arrangement of, you know, joint governance in which workers have some autonomy, some voice, and in which they're, you know, you just have a cooperative relationship with some degree of, you know, managerial hierarchy, but something that is more like a representative democracy. Not so bad.
I've been speaking with political philosopher Elizabeth Anderson. We're talking about her book, Private Government, How Employers Rule Our Lives and Why We Don't Talk About It. You can find a link to that book on our website, againstthegrain.org. Her other books include The Imperative of Integration. Elizabeth, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.